Anyway, good evening. Welcome you to tonight's Northern Regional Advisory Committee, or Council, sorry. My name's Bryce Thurgood. I'm the chair of the Northern RAC. I represent the at-large, and I'm from Perry. We'll do a introduction, and we'll start with Melissa.
Melissa Wood, representing the Bureau of Land Management.
Kevin McLeod, Plain City, at-large.
Mike Lauder, Sportsman's Rep, Hooper.
Kristen Purdy, non-consumptive, Ogden.
Justin Oliver, at-large, West Haven.
David, do you want to start on your end? We'll come back.
David Earl, at Northern Utah.
Matt Clark, Ogden, at-large.
Aaron Johnson, West Weber County Sportsman.
Chris Oakstrom, Ogden, non-consumptive.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
Justin Doling with the Division of Wildlife. I serve as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Thank you. We want to recognize Byron Bateman in the audience on the back row from the Wildlife Board. He's always good about coming to all of our meetings. We appreciate that and want to recognize him. If you guys would mind taking a second and turning your cell phones off, or not off, but to silent, just so we can have a uninterrupted meeting. It's muchly appreciated. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management policy rules and regs. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the 5 regional advisory councils and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. Please respect everyone's right to an opinion, even if it conflicts with yours. No clapping or vocal outbursts, because we'll kick you out. This meeting will be recorded for the transcription of the minutes. The audio recording and minutes will be available at the DWR website. When speaking, please use the microphone. Jody wants to make sure, since this is a building we haven't used a lot, that we talk into it so it records good. So make sure you are up close and it's audible. Speakers should state their name and if they wish, where they're from. So, and also, I'll probably call for a vote just because it's a different setup, and so she can make sure and see who's voting. So, with that being said, please take a look at the agenda for tonight's meeting. And does anybody have any objections to that agenda? If not, we will approve the agenda for tonight's meeting. The minutes from the previous meeting. Does anybody have questions or concerns over the minutes from the previous meeting? Okay. If not, we will approve those as circulated. The next thing we've got is the Wildlife Board update. Justin, if I say anything wrong, please feel free to correct me. But this meeting was from the January 10th Wildlife Board meeting. It was from our December meeting. Black bear was one of the main topics in that meeting. There was a motion to not accept the division's recommendation as presented on the committee and re-meet and discuss it. That passed 6-0. There was a motion action log item to look at the spring pursuit and number of hounds with the bear committee. That motion was and there was a motion to accept the division's proposal on the book cliffs as presented. That passed 6-0. There was a motion to keep the beaver bear tag numbers the same. That passed 5-1. And there was a motion to accept the balance as presented. That passed 6-0. On to the antelope. There was a motion to keep the Cisco South unit at 375 on the, that was on the population objective, I believe. And that passed 5-1. And then there was a motion to on the balance, and it passed 6-0. The next one was on the moose. It was a motion to accept the presentation as presented. That passed 6-0. The CHA rule amendment passed 6-0. The sage grouse, that passed as presented 5-0, one excused. We had one wildlife board member leave. North Peak CWMU variance passed 5-0. Another CWMU advisory committee appointment passed as presented 5-0. Number 12 was a tilapia farmer variance, prohibited species variance. That passed as presented 5-0. The 13th item was a wildlife board stipulation, a license penalty. Anyway, there was two of them. They passed 4-1 and 5-0. And then the last item on there was the closure on Antelope Island. As you guys know, the disease that has affected all those sheep out there. And there was a motion to close Antelope Island and cancel the two tags that were out there. And that passed 5-0. So anybody has any questions on the Wildlife Board meeting? If not, I will turn the time over to Justin for the regional update.
Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome out to the Regional Advisory Council meeting. Just got a quick update with just some highlights of what's going on in our region. In our aquatic section, they've been busy spawning walleye out at Willard. The goal for that project is to spawn about 28 million eggs. Right now they're sitting at a little over 20 million, so they should be wrapping things up, if not the end of this week, the following week. The reason we're spawning those walleye is to fertilize the eggs, transport them to the hatchery, have them treated in a way that produces a sterile fish, and then use that sterile fish to stock waters that may have species that we don't want to have undue pressure from walleye, and particularly walleye that are able to reproduce. So like those reservoirs of the Colorado drainage and other waters here in the state. The Great Salt Lake Project, there was a bill this year at the legislature to establish the new Willard Spur Waterfowl Management Area. Our waterfowl staff will be writing a management plan for the area. They're in the process of assembling a committee to help direct that management plan, and we'll see where that goes. So we're kind of excited to have a new waterfowl management area on the eastern shore of the Great Salt Lake. The waterfowl crew is also busy mowing frag bodies with the new marsh masters they received. I believe they received those, I want to say, late last winter. It was a cooperative project with SFW and a match with our federal aid program to acquire three nice new marsh masters that make their job in mowing and spraying phragmites much easier. And you know the challenges we have with burning, so we're unable to burn and because of air quality issues, so these machines can get right out there and mow that stuff down and get it decomposed quicker. In our habitat section, they're identifying some funding opportunities
for the watershed restoration initiative projects. They're also have been assisting the Mule Deer Foundation with a planting up on our Middle Fork WMA. It's my understanding they planted about 3,500 shrubs consisting of bitterbrush, sagebrush, and serviceberry. And Mike, I believe this is year three on that, isn't it? So hopefully some of those young seedlings are starting to grow up a little bit. Oh, cool. In our law enforcement section, we have a new canine unit here in the region. Matt Burgess has a black lab that's been going through training. It'll be up in our CASH unit, and it's used to, it's being trained right now to specialize in tracking people and finding evidence. In our wildlife section, they've been busy conducting lek counts on sage grouse and sharptail. They're also completing some of our spring deer classifications, and it's been a real tough winter for big game, not only on the CASH but throughout the region with this long persisting winter we've had. And our study animals right now on the CASH, the fawns, the last I heard, all our fawns had perished, so we have zero survival for fawns on the CASH this year. So with that, unless there's questions, I'll turn it back to the chair.
The fawns that didn't survive were just the collared fawns.
These are just collared fawns, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's, well, hopefully there's a few that survived.
It doesn't look good when all of the collared ones die, though. Does anybody else have any questions on the regional update? You want to add anything on the Middle Fork? Cool. Okay. We will proceed as follows. A representative from the division will come up and make a presentation on the agenda item. Then we will have questions from the public. And this is, most of the people have been here, but this is a question only. This is not a comment period. So questions. Then we'll take questions back to the rack, and then we will come back to the public and take comments from the public on the agenda items. Persons representing themselves will have 3 minutes. Persons representing organized groups will have 5 minutes to comment. In either case, fill out a blue comment card. They're in the back corner. Either give them to David on this side or Jody on this side to get to us. At the end of the public comment period, the public portion of that agenda item ends, and further public participation will only be at the request of the council for clarification. So next, the council will comment on the agenda items, and then the council will make motions recommending actions by the wildlife. Recommending action by the Wildlife Board on the agenda item. Deliberate those motions and then vote. Council members who wish to abstain from voting will state their conflict, and council members voting in opposition to a motion will provide their reasoning. Then we'll go on to the next agenda item. And I think Melissa might have to remind me after, please, because I forget every time. If they want to tell us why they didn't vote. So anyway, that being said, we will go to item number 5, the one and only Kobe Jones.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Kent puts his water ball on the ground and blames when I kick it. So we're supposed to stand over here. Should. At the beginning, we just say we'd state our name, say where we're from. Kobe Jones.
Thank you.
From Castledale, God's country.
I'm glad you put your phone down and quit watching cartoons and participated in the meeting, finally.
Seriously, super important business. All right, with that, we'll get started on taking big game and drawing procedures and just a few changes that we're recommending to these two different rules. Starting with the big game rule, this first change we're recommending allows an individual to take more than one pronghorn, doe pronghorn, in the situation where there's a depredation situation. So it allows the landowner to help alleviate the problems that he has in a depredation situation. And before this, if you had a buck permit, you couldn't have a doe permit. And we've had some problems there. The second recommended change is really a clarification. This part of the rule was messy at best, but what it clarifies is that a hunter may have only one desert, a bighorn, and one Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep permit in the same year, but they could have one of each. There is that possibility. This is very similar to other once-in-a-lifetime species. You could have a moose permit and a bighorn permit, but you couldn't have two moose permits. I should mention this primarily will affect the conservation permit holders or export permits. This change, this recommendation comes from this aligns rule with the bighorn sheep plan that we just passed last fall. So in the bighorn sheep plan, one of the issues that came up between producers and the division, one of the things we really had to work through is the fact that bighorn sheep are being used to exclude producers from the landscape, sheep producers specifically. And in Utah, we've taken the stand that no, we can have both. We can have sheep producers and we can have bighorn sheep, and we're going to manage a little differently, and we'll assume some of that risk. Well, with that, the producers also assume some of the risk. And one of the things that they wanted to be able to do in order to do two things: one, protect their domestic sheep herds and protect their ability to graze, and two, to protect our bighorn sheep herds, was to be able to remove a bighorn sheep when the animal came into a domesticated sheep herd so that it doesn't have the chance to go back to the bighorn herd and spread disease. This rule change will allow us to do that. A few of the conditions: before a producer went out on the landscape, if they knew there was a possibility for conflict, they would have to apply for a certificate of registration, and the division would review each one of these individually to see if that's the management strategy we want to use there. After that, after they're granted a certificate of registration, they go out. If they do have a conflict, they have to notify the division within 24 hours after removing the animal. Upon notification, all parts and pieces, including the head, the horns, and the cape, would come back, and the division would take those and donate them, use them for educational purposes, whatever we could do to make sure that they don't go to waste. And there's that change. We're recommending a change in any legal weapon. If you remember, the last round of racks, we had a sentiment of a different type of hunt. And the request was for more of a primitive hunt. And trying to understand that, we put together a committee, and we went through this, and we defined what that would look like to have a primitive hunt, because the division's answer is, well, we don't have anything like this in rule. We don't have a method to do this or apply this. And we put together what I felt like were some pretty good suggestions, and then we sat down and really looked hard at it and scrapped it completely because it was complicated. And as an agency, we're already complicated enough. So we wanted to find something that was less complicated but would still provide a different niche. And so we went with this recommendation. It's the handgun archery muzzleloader hunt. And one of the reasons we went with this recommendation is because there are other states around us, specifically Arizona, that already has one of these hunts in place. It's familiar to hunters if they hunt out of state and in other areas, and it's pretty simple. Basically, the hunt would be you could hunt with a handgun, archery, or muzzleloader weapon type. The season would overlap, and you could do that, but you got to pull the optics off. So there are no scopes, not on the pistols and not on the muzzleloaders. We did further define a pistol because there are some crazy pistols out there, and it wasn't the intent to have a AR receiver with a pistol grip. So we defined a pistol to make it be more of what we think of when we think of a pistol. Uh, And finally, the recommended change for the youth-only application groups. This change just aligns antlerless with what we do for antlered animals, and that is it allows the youth to apply as a group for antlerless hunts. So it's just aligning with current practice with bucks and bulls. And before, if youth applied as a group, it would kick them out of the permits that are allocated to youth, and they would just be in the regular draw. Now they can apply as a youth, and they stay in that, so they have better draw odds, essentially. And that's all.
Thank you. Questions from the public?
Where do they ask questions at? Do we have a second mic? Or?
I would just right here. Probably going to have to share with them.
Oh.
Sorry, Colby. You feel uncomfortable when people stand by you?
Kind of.
Okay. Questions from the rack. Matt.
Just to clarify, Kobe, on the antlerless pronghorn permits, those are just depredation permits, not other draw permits?
In the situation, yeah, in depredation situations, yes.
John?
So this new muzzleloader pistol archery, where are you going to fit that in the grand scheme of time?
That is a really good question, John. So this is the first step, getting it into rule. But before we did it in practice, we'd want to get it in a management plan and take that back through the public process to make sure that we're really doing what the public wants. Because, I mean, this is social. This isn't biological. It doesn't matter what weapon type you use to harvest an animal. And so it's not in the management plan yet. The next step would be to use it as a strategy and a management plan, and I'm not sure exactly what that would look like. I don't know.
So realistically, it could be a couple of years, a year or two away.
It could be. Yeah. We're rewriting the deer management plan right now. Maybe it'll make it in as a strategy in there.
Covey, where are landowners experiencing depredation from pronghorns?
Oh, they love alfalfa. Anywhere they're pronghorn and alfalfa, they're experiencing depredation.
So county, what counties?
It'd be every county they're pronghorn in. Yeah. Randy, for the northern region, it would be Box Elder, Rich, and those two primarily.
Do you have any stats on how many landowners are reporting depredation?
Absolutely. We have all those stats. It's comprehensive, but yeah, we have an app that tracks every depredation incident across the state.
Can you give us an idea of how many, depredation incidences those are? We're talking dozens.
Mike, how long would that take to pull up? You can pull that up and come back to that.
Thank you.
Any other questions while he's looking that up? Go ahead.
And I'll apologize. I'm sorry. I just couldn't get off work any quicker.
Wait 1 second. Introduce yourself, and then you can ask your question.
Randy Hutchison, Ogden at large.
Okay.
So I did do the reading beforehand. I really wanted to get here for your whole presentation. But it was touched on a little bit. I'm a little concerned about the potential for the new primitive weapon hunt. We already have a bow hunt. We already have a muzzle hunt. The pistols are already addressed under any weapon. Mm-hmm. And my concern is when does it fit in? I know you said we don't know, but isn't this just opening the door to that hunt's approved now, the type of hunt's approved now, so we're just going to find another week, 2 weeks to fit it in where there's already nonstop?
Maybe, or maybe we would use it on a unit where we don't have a lot of pressure, a lot of hunters. So maybe it would be more of not fitting it into the current structure, but fitting it into an area where we don't have a lot of hunters using the other weapon types. That's one possibility. And you're right. I think the point you're making is that and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm saying, is that fall's pretty full,
yeah,
right now as it is. Yeah. And that's accurate. Another place that I could see this being used is the Vision gets accused sometimes of catering to archers. You know, we offer a lot of opportunity in archery, and the reason we do is because they're not as effective. And so when we remove the optics from these other weapons, essentially where we use archery in some places, we could use this as another tool that will allow somebody who is not an archer but likes to hunt black powder or wants to try to hunt with a handgun. And so it just, and we do have areas where we have archery only or extended archery, or so it just would allow another possibility other than always going to archery.
Would, but if this were approved, does it mean, I mean, is it just the slippery slope? Is it just guaranteed we're going to put that in somewhere? Because the fall being fall is true, because I know people that won't go up in the mountains all the time. I'm a big bird hunter. Utah's mountains. And yeah. Once you know, the deer hunt starts, I leave the state because there's just, it's nonstop.
I don't have a good answer for you, but like I said, it would be vetted again through the public process and a management plan, probably. And then vetted again through the public process when it comes forth as a hunt recommendation.
Oh, sorry. Here, let's let him answer this, and then you can go to Kevin.
So for the northern region, this past year, we've had just over 30 complaints on pronghorn alone here in the northern region. Other regions are more. Look at the southeast region, they had about 50. Southern region is similar. Statewide, we've issued 740 pronghorn depredation permits and over 1,000 vouchers this year.
Thank you.
That was Mike Wardle, Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator.
Thank you. Kevin.
So, Colby, back on the primitive hunt, you said that it needs to go through a vetting process, and I think you said that you'd want to determine whether the public really wants it or not. So my question is, what created or what precipitated this hunt even being considered?
The public came last fall and said they wanted it.
Okay, so there has been a public. So that was a little confusing to me when you said, does the public really want it?
Yeah, but, you know, it's we try to fully vet ideas before we actually go out and do them. And this one's probably on its way, but it might not quite be there yet. The only way we could try it is get it in rule and then see if it's something that works.
Chris.
When you say the public wanted it, can you just give us a little bit more detail? What, you know, was it 15 people or 15,000 people, or what's enough to make you want to move on it?
Yeah, some of these things, when we write a plan, we do a lot of survey questions. So we'll survey a random sample of our hunters for a specific species. Sometimes this is the public. And if people show up to these meetings and care enough to show up and mention it, that's probably it's weighed pretty heavily for us. So not always a number, but those who show up and speak sometimes too. Those who respond to a survey.
Okay. Thank you. We don't have any more questions. Oh. You got a question? You got a comment card? We are. So you want to come up and...
Do I really have to share the mic with Troy?
You don't want to. You don't have to.
Come on, buddy.
Just kidding.
Chair is for...
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Two things. I'd like to voice our support for that, of the removal of bighorn sheep through our sheep producers. Sat on the statewide sheep committee. Talked that through. This is a very important tool to protect our bighorns as well as our producers, so we support that. We'd also like to voice our support for the primitive weapon. And I'll tell you where it came from. It actually came from a committee of people down in southern Utah. And the whole idea behind this primitive weapon is to find a way that we can increase opportunity and decrease success, meaning putting the hunt back into hunt. We have rifles today that are 1,500-yard guns, 1,000-yard guns. Muzzleloaders, they're 600-700 yards. And the whole idea was to create something that you got to get a lot closer, you can put more people in the field, and you decrease the harvest, actually. And so, you know, some of the areas that we were looking at using this, one area that was just thrown out is any of those you're familiar with Green River and the Book Cliffs, you get a lot of deer that come out of the roadless and come off the tribe. And at the time of year they come off, all the hunts are over. And possibly starting some of those hunts in those areas to take advantage of it, things that aren't available to us currently during the normal seasons. Then also instituting it during the normal time frame. But that's where it comes from, so we'd like to voice our support for it. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other comments? If not, we'll go back to comments from the RAC. I was one personally that voted against variable scopes on muzzleloaders for the record a couple years ago, so I like the primitive weapon thing too. We're too efficient of killers these days. So, I like the idea myself. I'm guilty, but I voted against it. No other comments or motions? Matt?
I motion to accept the presentation as presented.
Okay, got a motion to... Okay.
He seconded?
John did. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? One opposed. And we got 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. 10 in favor, 1 opposed. Okay, thank you. Oh.
Yeah, I'm going to jump in here. Ask him why.
Thank you, Melissa.
Increase in permits and stuff, don't have any problem with. I think the primitive weapon hunt, we have it. Remove the scopes from the muzzle loaders. It's just going to create another season, more constant, nonstop pressure. So I agree. The muzzle loaders, it was a huge mistake to put scopes on them. Shouldn't have happened. And we've got already have primitive weapon hunts. We don't need to create another special one.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Number 6. Probably you're up again.
Sweet. You guys will be sick of me by the end of the night. I promise. All right. Here to present this time the...
We might be sick of you already, so...
Yeah. Or by the 2019... bucks, bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. You know, as we went through the PowerPoint this year, we all understand what we're trying to accomplish as division employees and wildlife biologists, but we realized that we've never, ever taken the presentation and stepped back for a second and explained to the public and everybody exactly why we make the recommendations that we make or where they come from. And so this slide does exactly that. So... the first thing that a biologist takes into account is herd health and not doing anything that is damaging to a population. You know, as a biologist, we make recommendations. We strive to make recommendations that that will not do any damage. That doesn't mean that we don't at times reduce populations, and at times reduction in population is the healthiest thing for a population. But we don't want to do anything that's detrimental or to a population. After that, as you can see, these two photos, one on the right, one on the left, there's always this pendulum between quality and opportunity when we're talking, especially hunting of bucks and bulls, right? And I find myself asking a lot, you know, who's right? You know, is it the hunter on my right-hand side who harvested a large antlered animal, or is it the other hunter that went out and had a great time and she also harvested a buck? And the truth is, they're both right. There's not a wrong up there. So a lot of the recommendations we present are social, and especially when we're talking hunting of bucks and bulls. So in order to make social recommendations, we write management plans. And when we write a management plan, we write that plan with a diverse group of constituents. So it's not just the division sitting in a room. After we write that plan with a diverse group of constituents, we take that plan through the public process and allow the public to have input on that plan and to mold and shape and change. And then after that, we make recommendations to manage to the plan that we all agreed upon. And so when you see a recommendation from the division, it's a biologist trying to make a recommendation to manage to what we've already agreed to manage to with the public. And with that, we'll start in right on the 2019 general season limited entry deer permit recommendations. So last year overall was a good year for harvest on Utah. On the y-axis there you have the number of deer harvested across the state, and on the x-axis you have the year. And in 2018, we harvested right at 30,000 deer. So the last 3 years have been some of the best deer hunting years in recent history for the state. When we look at our statewide buck doe ratios, and you'll notice in the caption at the top, we removed the private land dominated units, because if you include those, it's much higher than this. When we look at the public land units, on the left, you have the number of bucks per 100 does, which is a metric we use to manage bucks in the landscape. And on the x-axis, you have the years. And overall, our state average, we're right at 19. So we're right at the top end of what we'd be managing for as a state. We manage our general season units for either 15 to 17 or 18 to 20. And so on both, on average, we're right there at the top end. When you look at our fawn production trends, this last year we dipped down about 53 fawns per 100 does. We like to see this number at about 60, and losing a few fawns, that matters. And a lot of this is due to the severe droughts that we've seen in portions of the state. So with that, last year we issued 90,650 permits, and this year we're recommending 90,450. That's no change on 15 units, recommending an increase on 7 units and a decrease on 7 units. One more thing before we get into the units and permits, just to keep in mind is what is the spirit of general season deer hunting? You know, Utah already we have limited entry units. We have premium limited entry units. And so I would suggest that the spirit of general season is to offer as much opportunity as we can to hunters while still maintaining the quality we've agreed to in the plan. And we do that as best we can. So if you look at this, this is a projection of it's both what has happened as far as permits go and what's happening into the future. So again, on the y-axis, you have the number of applicants. And then on the x-axis, you have the year. And you can see, in 2007 and 2008, everybody in the state of Utah that wanted to hunt deer was able to. And since then, we've been increasing between 7 and 10% annually, to where the first year, 2009, not everybody got to hunt deer. You know, now as we sit in 2018, you have units where your draws are 1 in 3 at best. And it's just projected to get more difficult into the future. Starting in the northern region with our general season deer permit recommendations, and on the box elder, right there, our three-year average is at 18. Or I guess on the very left hand, you'll see the unit, followed by the objective that we're managing to, the last 3 years classification data, and followed by the three-year average. And when we make a recommendation, we take into account two things. One is trend in the buck doe ratio, and the other is the three-year average. And then followed by, we have last year's permits, last year's recommended permits, and then this year's recommended permits. So if you look at the box elder, we did have an increase out there last year. We are slightly above, but this year came in under. And for that reason, we're recommending to stay the same. Also recommending on the Morgan Chalk Creek East Canyon, Morgan South Ridge, that is the longest name ever. Seriously, could you change the name? So on that unit, well above, we all understand that there are some private lands issues, and throwing more permits at that unit doesn't necessarily mean more opportunity. We had a very healthy increase there last year with that early season, and the biologists felt comfortable leaving that where it is. On the Camas, again, above, healthy increase last year, out of the early season, recommending to leave that where it is as well. No recommended changes in the northern region. On to the central region, on the Oker Stansberry unit, where we're exceeding, we're recommending a slight increase there of 300 permits. And that's the net increase for the unit. In the southern region, and the southern region is part of the southern region, some of the areas in the southern region were most affected. Southern, southeastern, and portions of northeastern Utah were most affected by this drought we had this last year. So starting with the Beaver, where you see that downward trend, these are all 18 to 20 units. You see that downward trend and recommending a decrease there. On the Fillmore, again, even though exceeding, a steep downward trend there, recommending a slight decrease. The Monroe, recommending a decrease there. Downward trend on the Dutton. And on the Panguitch Lake, we're below and recommending a decrease there. On the Pine Valley, still exceeding there and recommending an increase there. And then on the Plateau Boulder Kaparowitz, below and below on the average and below on the trend, and recommending a decrease there. Southern region continued, the Plateau Fish Lake. We're recommending a slight decrease there as we're slightly below the three-year average. And then the Plateau Thousand Lakes. This unit should warrant an increase. It's a very difficult unit. It's small. And when we rewrite the statewide deer plan, we'll probably evaluate whether or not this should remain as a standalone unit. It just doesn't handle very many permits. So we are exceeding, but we're recommending to stay the same there. On the Zion, we're exceeding and have been for the last several years and recommending an increase there. Overall, in the southern region, recommending a reduction of 1,075 permits, about 5% for this next year. In the southeastern region, on the 9 Mile, again, a lot of private land on this unit, but when we talked to the biologist, in conversations back and forth, the two biologists that managed this, they felt like with the addition of that early hunt, there is a little bit room, more room to increase there, a little bit again. And then on the San Juan Abajo Mountains, that unit was one of the units that was hit heaviest by drought. It might not show up in the buck-doe ratio this year, but we know that this next year we should be showing a significant decline. It can handle the number of permits that it's had, but we're not recommending an increase. On the North Slope in the northeastern region, right at the top of the objective there, recommending an increase. South Slope Bonanza Vernal, exceeding and recommending an increase. South Slope Yellowstone, exceeding and recommending an increase. And Wasatch Mountains East, we're within, and the biologists would like to watch that one more year. Under the 2019 limited entry and premium limited entry deer permit summary recommendations. You'll see, just looking down there, that they're recommending increases across all weapon types except for the late season muzzleloader hunts. Those are the hunts that occur in general season units, and the management buck hunts. For the late season muzzleloader hunts, that's because two of the units that had those hunts fell out this last fall. In order to have one of those hunts, you have to be an 18 to 20 unit and be exceeding, and they both dropped down into the objective, so didn't qualify anymore. And then the management buck hunt, I'll get into the reason for that right now. Overall, a net increase in permits, 14. So under our premium limited entry, first the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagon. These two units, the permits are set for both of these units in the statewide plan. And the way it reads is that as long as at least 40% of the harvest is at least 5 years old or older, we will maintain the number of permits that we had the previous year. And so we're meeting those objectives for both units and recommending no change to either the Henry Mountains or the Ponce Gun. Buck doe ratios on our premium limited entry units are managed, they're managed a little bit differently in that they are managed with management buck hunts. So that allows a hunter to go out and harvest a deer that has 3 points or less on one side. So for the Ponce Gun, where we've had steady buck doe ratios the last several years, we're at 49.3, right there in the middle of the objective. We're recommending the same number of permits. On the Henry Mountains, where we've had some decline and we're at the lower end of the objective, we're recommending a decrease there. On the Ponce Gun cactus buck, however, that hunt last year was the first year we did it. Overall reviews were positive on that cactus buck hunt. Some of the individuals that drew the tag, some of the hunters that drew the tag, I don't think it was exactly what they'd expected. They'd expected a crazy freak, big mule deer, and some of these look more like Marge Simpson. Overall positive experience, and I were able to offer some more opportunity there. Under our limited entry deer permit recommendations, starting with the Book Cliffs. The Book Cliffs, as you see, were at the top end of the objective and exceeding and not recommending a permit increase. And that might seem, or it does seem weird or counterintuitive. We would like to offer more opportunity there. The Book Cliffs could be the unit. It was one of the units, or maybe the unit state, that was hit hardest by this last summer's drought. And there could possibly be some differential survival there between bucks and does. We lost 40% of our does on this unit this last year. And so just the feeling that we don't have the ability to offer that increase right now in monitoring. Fillmore Oak Creek, Cash Crawford Mountain, a slight increase of one there. Fillmore Oak Creek, recommending an increase there. North Slope Summit, we learned some really interesting things about this. This is the high country buck hunt that happens early in the Uintas. And we've always thought that these deer, summer in the Uintas and then head north and into the Wyoming, into that winter range, plenty of winter range, pretty vast there. And we collared a bunch of these deer this year. And we learned that there's not a north-south migration. There is an east-west migration. So essentially we're hunting these animals twice. We hunt them up there and then they move over towards Diamond Mountain. So they move from the west to the east. Where we increase general season permits, we are recommending a reduction in the limited entry permits here. On San Juan Elk Ridge, exceeding and recommending an increase there. And then on the West Desert Vernon, we're exceeding and recommending an increase there as well. Overall increase from 961 to 982 permits. These are the late season limited entry muzzleloader permits. No change except for the Monroe, where it fell out, and the Plateau Fish Lake, where it fell out, reducing total permits by 10 from 172 to 162. Okay, so as part of management plans, there are a few species in the state that we've decided to use average age as a surrogate for quality and to see what's going on in the landscape. And we manage elk, pronghorn, and moose to average age. And so when you see a recommendation from the division on either elk, pronghorn, or moose, that's due to the data that comes in on average age. And on the right here, that photo, it's a tooth, and those are cementum bands. Much like tree rings, when an animal hits a period of low nutrition, they lay down a new band. And so pull the tooth, cut the tooth, sand the tooth, and you can tell how many winters they've lived through. So starting with our general season permits, recommending no change to the spike bull and any bull and youth bull. Spike bull permits are set in the plan. As long as the harvest isn't above 20%, we don't recommend decreasing this. I want to point out that even with the addition of the multi-season permit that we introduced this last year, we were at 15% on spike harvest. Here's an overview of the limited entry permits by weapon type. So recommending increases across all weapon types, an overall net increase recommended on all of our limited entry elk units of 75%, or of 75 permits, or about 3%. Starting with the oldest age class that we manage for in the state, looking at the Beaver East, we're right at the top end of the objective there and have the ability to offer some increase, and so we're recommending an increase there. On the Book Cliffs Little Creek, we're below and recommending a decrease there. Plateau Boulder Kaparowitz, we're right at the top end and recommending an increase there. And then the West Desert Deep Creek, as you'll see, last year was below and the average is below. But we have to have enough harvest on the landscape to see what's going on. And 20 is about as low as we can go. This is one of the units that changed in the last elk plan. We're waiting to see if it will actually come into the objective or not. On our 6.5 to 7-year-old units, on the Bookless Bitter Creek, with that last year, that drop in that the steady drop in the drop in the last 2 years, recommending a decrease there. Cache South, we're below, and the last year was below as well, and recommending a decrease there. Central Mountains Nebo, again below and recommending a decrease. On the Monroe, we're within the objective but at the top end and recommending a slight increase of 2 permits. Mount Dutton, we're below and recommending a decrease, as well as the Panguitch Lake. And then on South Slope Diamond Mountain, above, as well as the Southwest Desert, and recommending increases on both of those. Overall, on the 6.5 to 7, we're recommending a decrease of 22 permits. On our 5.5 to 6-year-old units we manage for, Central Mountains Manti, we're above last year, above 2 of the last 3 years, and overall above on the average, and recommending an increase there. And then on to the 9 Mile Anthro, above and recommending an increase. North Slope Three Corners, below and recommending a decrease. On the Oker Stansberries, you can see we're below on the 3-year average, but we're not recommending a decrease because, again, about 20 animals. We need to be able to harvest to see what's going on. Plateau Fish Lake, at the very top end and recommending an increase, in Wasatch Mountains West above, again recommending an increase. And our 4.5 to 5-year-old units, so Box Elder Grouse Creek above and recommending an increase. And Box Elder Pilot Mountain, and this one is the weirdest recommendation of the night probably, above and recommending a decrease. This is because we hunt this unit in conjunction with Nevada, and they got their permit recommendations in first. So we have an agreement with Nevada that we won't issue more permits than they do. We'll work through this earlier next year and be able to recommend the appropriate number of permits. Cache Meadowville, right at the top of the age objective there, and recommending an increase. Overall increase of 10 permits, about 4%, the 4.5 to 5-year-old units. For Pronghorn, remember that when we passed the new statewide management plan for Pronghorn, we're now managing on age, managing for a 2 to 3-year-old buck in the harvest. And recommending a pretty healthy increase. This is the first year, so we had age data on Pronghorn for several years, and then we stopped for several years. And so last year, when we did this first age-based management, we had to go off of data that was several years old. When the ages came in this year, we had a lot of room for increase, and so we're recommending an increase of 178 permits, or about 20%, and realizing that we have more opportunity to offer in Pronghorn. And there is research that demonstrates that Pronghorn buck survival is about 80% a year, and so by managing for an older age class Pronghorn, you lose a lot to natural mortality. Onto the 2019 once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. Quick reminder that we did pass new plans for both mountain goats and sheep, and we did that, we changed the permit guidelines for both of those species. So we just go through what the old guidelines were, what the new guideline is, and what that means as far as permit recommendations. So for mountain goats first, the previous guideline was 5 to 15% of the counted population. That included nannies, kids, billies. The new recommendation is 5 to 25%, but of the counted adult population, so it excludes kids. And that's a better way of doing it. So when we look at the beaver, we had, just as an example, we had 110 counted adults, 139 total count. Under the previous guideline, we would have been able to issue 7 to 20 permits. Under the updated guideline, we can issue 6 to 27. I should mention that the sentiment behind this, when we wrote both the mountain goat and the statewide sheep plans, were that the public really, and when we bought it through the process too, they wanted more opportunity for these species. If we could offer it, they wanted to see more opportunity. New objectives in the bighorn plan. The previous guideline was recommend permits based on 12 to 15% of the counted rams, so total count of rams, or 30 to 40% of the counted rams at least 6 years old or older. The updated guideline is recommended permits based on 12 to 25% of the counted rams, or 30 to 60% of the counted rams at least 6 years old or older. So if we just go through the Caparowitz West example, counted 96 rams, 40 of those were at least six. Previous guidelines would have allowed us to issue 12 to 16 permits. Under the new guidelines, we could issue 12 to 24 permits. So breaking this down by species, for moose, again, with the age objective we managed for there, we've got some ability to offer more opportunity in moose, increasing from 84 to 97. On bison, you'll notice that last year's bison permits, that 256 does include the additional 109 permits that we brought before the board last fall when we hit a severe drought on the Henrys. And so we included that in this to show the 225 represents a reduction in permits on the Henrys and recommending increasing permits on the Bookcliffs as that population comes into its population objective. Recommending 21 permits, increase of one permit on the bison archery. That's divided up into two hunts this year, so both a cow hunt and an either sex hunt. Recommending an increase in desert bighorn sheep from 56 to 66 with three archery permits, and that hunt is on the Zion unit, that archery hunt. In the Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep, recommending an increase 39 to 52 with four archery permits, and that is on the Newfoundland Mountains. For mountain goats, even under the new guidelines, we're recommending a decrease in permits, and that is because the Willard Peak is one of our primary sources for mountain goats. This last flight came in, the population was lower than it had been in the past, and we're recommending a reduction there. And that's why the overall net reduction from 117 to 112. Recommending 14 archery permits, and 10 of those are on a new archery hunt on the Nebo. And that's all.
Thank you. Questions from the public? Questions from the rack? Mike.
Covey, just out of curiosity, does private land play in any factor when you're determining age? And specifically the Meadowville, where it's a largely private land unit. Does that affect the age that you get? When you're adding tags, you're pretty much adding them to private landowners, right? Because there's a very small portion of public land. So that's my question, sorry.
It does affect it. And if you want to speak specifically about that unit, we'll probably have Randy or the biologist come up and talk about it. But it can affect it sometimes.
Honestly. Isn't along with like his lines, we used to, I mean, on the Morgan South Ridge, because it had so much private, you guys would take that into consideration. So it kind of, you know, where you in your graphs tried to go with the public land and not the private land, because that unit in particular has so much private, we'll never kill enough, put enough tags on the state WMA and stuff like that.
Right. Jim Christensen, Cache District Wildlife Biologist. For the Meadowville, yeah, the elk over there do spend the majority of the time on private land. There is a little bit of public ground where they will use. We have some collar data showing where that is. So we do know that they will get on public ground during the hunts. But yeah, it is increasing the amount of requests for public hunters to hunt on private land. And then we do, the majority of the northern region is a private lands, our private lands units. In like the Morgan South Ridge, East Canyon, Chalk Creek, we just go with the open any bowl strategy. So, you know, the private landowners, they can go buy a tag and have one of their buddies go and buy them or however they see fit. We have pitched that idea to the landowners in the Meadowville unit, and at this time they are not receptive to changing. Right.
Thank you, Jim.
I have another question. When you're talking about the new guidelines, you talked about counted. When you help me remember that the counted, is that a census? Is that something that you're doing like a statistical analysis on?
So we have a sightability index, and then it's a census. But it's actually physically counted them.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Sightability on sheep can vary a lot. But helicopter census.
I tried to find this on my page, and it's too many for me to find on my iPad, so I couldn't find it. It was on the Henry Premium. I believe we're managing to an average of 5 years.
Yes. Do you want me to go back to that slide?
Would you mind if you can find it? Because I couldn't find it on the handout. My question was, and I might be remembering this wrong, but I believe that the last 2 years, there's been a pretty steep drop.
Yeah.
And age there, but we, I believe, increased or kept those permits the same. Is there a concern with that because there was a pretty steep drop?
You know, as we see them decrease, you're right, and the biologist did bring up this concern. He's concerned about it, but we're still within. It's pretty remarkable to have the average buck be over 5 years old, and so where we're still at 46% last year. On the Henry Mountains, we're not at the target yet to say we would recommend a reduction.
So
we're watching it though.
So the 25%, it's not that scary then.
No, we're not. No, and the truth is that there has been some declines in quality on the Henrys. I don't think anybody in this room doesn't know that. It's probably more correlated to habitat and nutrition than it is to average age. It takes good nutrition to grow antler, and they had a big fire down there about 15 years ago. It produced an increase in both the population and the antler size. That fire is coming probably to the end of its lifespan where it had additional nutrients in the plant materials, and you start to see a reduction of both population and antler size. And where we'll back off, you'll have more older age class bucks, we'll back off those management permits. But that might not necessarily translate into increased quality again. It's hard, it's counterintuitive. To increase quality, you might want to harvest a few does. So where your gut says don't kill any more, the biology says you should probably harvest a few, and then the bucks that are there have better nutrition. Reduce the population.
A question on the cache. Do you think that...
Do you want me to go to that recommendation?
Yeah, please. You think... I mean, there was 2 years of... One more right there. Yeah, 2 years on the lower end of the spectrum. We got 1 year with a bump, but then this year we're seeing some mortality. I mean, get ahead of the pendulum, I guess, is what I'm...
Yeah, so with the bad winter 2 years ago and the poor survival, we cut permits at that point, and we were able to stabilize within objective our permit numbers and or our buck to doe ratios, and then actually show an increase up to 20 bucks per 100 does at postseason 2018. And so I feel like if we stay where we're at, we should still fall within objective post 2019.
Okay, thank you. One last question on the Zion. We added the archery hunt, but I've seen in the recommendations you took one from the early rifle, one from the late rifle, and then added three on the archery.
Yeah. Then
can you
elaborate on that?
No, can you just, do you think we could leave the numbers where they are on the rifles and still add the three archery and be all right?
It would be within the guidelines of the plan to do that, yes.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? We have no other questions. We have just one. Troy. Any other? Okay, Ben.
Troy Justinson, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Speaking to what you're talking about, Bryce, on the Zion Desert Sheep, it is our recommendation that we stay with last year's permit numbers. Part of this process of bringing in the archery hunts, we agreed that it wouldn't cut down opportunity on any weapon. But we also believe that this unit can support it. And one thing about the Zion is you have Zion National Park there, which is busting at the seams with sheep. And we continue, it's basically a built-in nursery that these sheep continue to come out. If there's one unit in the state that can manage the harvest, increased harvest rams, it is the Zion. So we'd recommend that we leave the permit numbers, I believe, at 10, and then also include the archery. The other concern we have is that of sheep, again, dealing with the Wasatch, the Vanaquin, the Nebo. In the past, they used to be separate units. We bunched them together to where we're issuing those permits, and the guys had the opportunity to jump all around. We know we can't fix it this year, but we'd support the division's recommendations with what they have this year, but we'd like to see them next year split those out. We're not opposed to the numbers, but our fear is that if you got, the potential is you got four or five guys that now can go to any one specific unit, and we feel it's a detriment to the quality and also the overall population of the sheep. So quite honestly, if we broke those out individually, we could probably have six permits, two on each. And so that would be our recommendation. Other than that, we support the rest of the division's recommendations. Thank you.
Ben.
Ben Lauder, representing the Utah Archery Association. Bryce, I'm glad you brought up that tag difference on the Zion. Just like Troy and SFW, we don't want to see those permits impacted on that rifle hunt either. So. As Kofi said, it does fall within the guidelines to keep those permits the same as they were last year, and that would be our recommendation. Aside from that, we support the division's recommendations as presented. Thank you.
Thank you. No other comment cards from the public? Not. We'll come back to the rack for comments.
Kofi, can you pull up that Zion unit just so we can visually see what they're talking about?
I don't have it split out in the presentation, but I can just explain it. What it is Zion has an early any weapon hunt and a late any weapon hunt, and those were reduced by one permit apiece, and then with the addition of three archery permits in another season. Yeah.
Were they all harvested? What was this? Did the additional permits impact? You know?
For, you mean last year?
Yes, last year.
You can assume with sheep and any weapon hunt that your harvest success is almost 100%. Usually, 90, high 90s.
We don't know on the archery.
We don't know on the archery. When we did the archery, we had to make some assumptions. The season dates are tough, and we estimated that it would be about 50%. But you've got to start somewhere. That's where we started. We could be wrong.
Kofi, is there not mandatory reporting on sheep?
Yeah, there is. So we'll know. They have to check them all in. But but we won't know until next year on archery.
So explain to me again of cutting down on the numbers and then adding is the success.
John, you're not. She's not being able to pick you up in the microphone. Sorry.
You have to ask it again.
I can't remember what I just said.
So let me clarify really quick for the RAC. The intent. Jason Nichols is a biologist on this unit. Great biologist, and the recommendations. It's a good recommendation. There's some leeway in the plan. His thought process was not to cut these permits to add them to archery. And so his thought process is he would have cut these two permits regardless, because when he flew the Zion this last year, he didn't see the number of rams that he'd seen in the past, or it dropped. But even with that said, and the Zion has traditionally been managed for more quality, if that makes sense. So there's the sideboards, there's room inside the sideboards, and some units we manage for more opportunity, and some units we manage for a little more quality, and this unit has traditionally been managed for a little bit more quality. And so the recommendation he made wasn't because of the archery permits, it was just because he'd seen fewer rams. But both recommendations fall within the guidelines of the plan, and if that's the direction the RAC would like to go, the division doesn't have a lot of heartburn either way there.
Go ahead, Chris.
Just with regard to the public comments, especially on the role of Zion National Park, do you have any thoughts on that?
It's accurate. You know, Zion, you can't hunt inside the park, so you end up with a lot of sheep and heavy ram ewe ratios inside the park.
And
I like the recommendations of the archery season. I think they were requested the last few years, and I'm glad we finally got them. Thanks for the clarification on the thought of the biologist, that he would have decreased them anyways. That being said, I'm an opportunity guy, and it's two rams is what they're requesting it stay at, one per season, right next to a large national park. I really think that they could sustain it and give somebody a chance in a lifetime to go hunt one of those. So I kind of like the public's recommendation myself.
Oh.
I just agree exactly what Aaron said, just for record.
Motion? Go ahead.
I'd make a motion that we accept the plan as presented, other than accept the recommendation and the request from SFW to leave those numbers on the Zion the same as last year, and then simply increase the archery permits.
Okay. Got a motion and a second to accept the plan as presented, with the exception to leave the permit numbers on the early and late rifle the same as last year, with the addition of the three archery tags.
Correct.
Okay. Discussion on the motion.
You got seconded?
Yeah, Justin seconded. Discussion on the motion? All in favor, raise your hand. Unanimous. Okay, thank you. Thank you. Oh, we're not done with you.
Nice try, Bryce.
Sorry, I was really hoping Mike would come up, but one more. Hopefully somebody's going to fill in for Justin other than you.
Well, can't do it.
You can say what you want after the meeting, just not during the meeting.
That's right. I'll bring a photo
after the meeting again. Thank you.
I'll bring a photo next time. All right, on to the 2019 antlerless recommendations. So again, backing up as to why the division makes antlerless recommendations. So antlerless recommendations, that is what ultimately dictates the number of animals on the landscape. Right, when we harvest females, we dictate how many are there to reproduce. And so the things that we consider when we're making antlers permit recommendations are the following. Manage to a population objective. State code requires that we manage and make recommendations toward population objectives. That's one reason to make it. Another one is herd health. We know more about wildlife, or have learned more about wildlife in the last 5 years than we knew all together in the past 100. And some of that comes from, we used to always use range as a surrogate of herd health. And now with body condition scores and captures and the work that Kent Hersey has done along with BYU, we don't have to use range as a surrogate anymore. We use the animals now. And so, and along with our biologists, all of our district biologists and hard work. So every year we get our hands on enough animals to see what condition they're in, how much fat they have. And that's another reason to make antlerless recommendations, if we really just have too many animals in any one area. We still do consider range health, though, because if we lose the range health, then we'll lose herd health. So if we see an area where animals are impacting the range, we'd make a recommendation to reduce that population there. And also to deal with the impacts on private property. So if we have an area where animals are significantly damaging private property and don't provide a lot of public benefit, that's another reason to have an antlerless hunt. So with that, we'll start with deer. You saw this graph earlier, our fawn production trends. So fawn doe ratios this last fall were lower, about 53. With that, overall, on a statewide average, our fawn survival, so this is December 1 to December 1, so December 1st, 2017, December 1st, 2018, 6 month old to a year and a half old, it increased. Our fawn survival increased overall statewide last year, just above 50%. Leads us to the modeled population objective. I've said this before, all models are wrong. Some models are useful. This is wrong. It's useful, though. You know, there aren't exactly 372,000 deer in the state, but we know that the trend is, we're about there, or that's how many we would have to get the buck-doe ratios we got at the end of the day. So a slight uptick, and you might ask why, with the drought we had this last year. We definitely lost deer in southern, southeastern, and the northeastern portions of the state. Whereas some of these central units, the Manti, and some of these other big units, we grew deer this last year. Under the summary of the total antlerless permits, in 2018 we recommended 1,955, and this year we're recommending 2,720. Breaking that down by unit, you can see the increases or decreases here. Starting in the northern region, increases in both the Chalk Creek and East Kangen area. That one of those East Kangen hunts, 500 of those permits, are on private lands only. And so it allows somebody who can get access to private land, or it allows a landowner to put in for a draw, and then at that point help solve some of their own problems with depredation. On the 9 mile, that's in and around the town of Green River and in and around the town of Price, recommending an increase there. San Juan Abajo, that unit is literally the city limits of Monticello. And so inside the city limits of Monticello, things are different in southern Utah. So recommending a decrease in the Panguitch Lake and Plateau Boulder. And recommending an increase on the Southwest Desert. We got rid of one of the hunts in and around Garrison and added a hunt in and around Cedar City, where we have some problems with urban deer and down there. And also recommending a reduction on the Zion. Overall, again, net increase of antlerless deer permits, 1955 to 2,720. On to elk. Under our statewide elk population trends, we true this every 3 years. So elk, we fly elk in a helicopter and count using the sightability index every 3 years, and then we model those populations in between based on harvest. And this last year, we were able to decrease that back towards the population objective. So if you look on the y-axis, it's the number of elk. Look on the x-axis, and it's the year. So in 2017, we're a little bit above and inching upwards. 2018, we reduced that back down to 79,000, right there, almost at the population objective. A reminder as to how we manage elk. So we've had to learn a lot managing elk. We knew how to manage deer, but elk and the number of elk we have in the state, this is relatively a new thing. And one of the things we've learned is elk are hard to manage at the population objectives. They're really smart, they avoid hunting pressure, and they change behaviors. And so in order to do that, that means that adding more hunters to the field doesn't always increase harvest success or get you in the direction you want to go to manage to your population objective. The one example I can think of on the Wasatch several years ago, we realized we were well above the population objective. We really increased permits and went from like somewhere in mid 60% success down below 30. And so it just doesn't result in more animals harvested. With that in mind, with elk, we do public draw permits. We do private lands only permits that are only valid on private land and sold over the counter. And anybody can buy one of those if they have access. That helps redistribute elk, and it also helps solve depredation problems. And we have antlers elk control permits on units where they're beneficial. So this allows a hunter to go and purchase a permit over the counter. If he has a buck or bull permit for a unit where this is, then they can then harvest a cow within that same within that unit. This is what the permits look like by year. About the same, relatively consistent between last year and this year. 9,635 public draw permits and 9,785 private lands only over-the-counter permits. Onto the unit by unit, starting in the northern region. You can look at the unit on the left, followed by the population objective and estimate, last year's recommendation, and this year's recommendation. So recommending a slight decrease on the box elder, close to the population objective there. On the cash, recommending an increase. On the camas, we're below the population objective, recommending a decrease. North Slope Summit, again below, recommending a decrease. And the Ogden, recommending a decrease there. I would just like to mention some of the units in the northern region. You can't just think of these three ways. We also have CWMUs that help us with antlerless harvest as well. On the northeastern region, and the book list well below and recommending a decrease there. 9 Mile Anthro above and recommending an increase. North Slope West Daggett were below and recommending a decrease, and South Slope Diamond Mountain above and recommending an increase. South Slope Yellowstone, this is another one where the recommendation makes less sense. This unit's tough. So we have antlers control permits here. There's a lot of tribal land spread out, and the antler elk control permits, it adds cow elk hunters to the field without adding additional pressure, and so sometimes with that we get additional harvest. We also have private lands only permits for this unit, and so adding additional public draw permits doesn't sometimes just creates frustrated hunters. This is a situation where that's probably accurate. Wasatch Mountains of Inequin, recommending 50 permits there, and overall net decrease in permits. Under the central region, Wasatch Mountains Nebo, where we're below the population objective, recommending a decrease, and West Desert, recommending an increase there. This is to target a group of elk in an area where we're not managing for elk, on the Vernon and around the Tinnick Valley. We have a group of elk building there. Overall net reduction in the central region. Onto the southeastern region, Central Mountains Manti, well below the population objective and recommending a decrease. On the Henry Mountains, we had a token 5 permits there for several years, and it just, not a lot of elk on the Henry Mountains, and we're going to recommend to continue to control that population through antlerless control permits. So recommending to get rid of that hunt. On the La Salle's, above and recommending an increase, and San Juan right at and recommending a slight decrease, overall net decrease in the southeastern region. On the southern region, above the population objective there on the Beaver and recommending an increase, and on the Fillmore, recommending a decrease there right below, as well as the big complex, the Monroe, Mount Benton, Panguitch Lake, recommending decreases on all of those where we're below. The Paunsagaunt, above what we're trying to manage for and recommending an increase. In the Pine Valley, we're right there and recommending a very slight increase. Plateau Boulder Kaparowitz, recommending a decrease there, as well as the Plateau Fish Lake, where we're below, recommending a decrease there. Southwest Desert, this one is one of those surprises. We have hit this unit hard over the past several years, and so when we flew it and it came in way higher than we anticipated, it was a little surprising. So the biologist is making a very aggressive recommendation there to try to bring that back to the population objective. The division would like to increase the population objective there, and one of the concessions we made in the unit management plan is that we would show that we could manage to the population objective in order to ask for that increase. And then on the Zion, recommending a slight increase there as well. Here's the new hunts. The maps are in the rack packets, and if you have any questions on those, they're at the end of the presentation as well, as far as the new hunts and the boundaries. Quick reminder that the two types of over-the-counter for sale permits, antler self-control. If you have a buck or bull permit, you can hunt an antler sale, no overlapping season date. And private lands only permits go on sale August 1st. Or permits go on sale July 23rd, but they're valid August 1st to January 31st. Some of the stats from this last year. Last year on antler sale control permits were available on 10 units. And with 3,400, almost 3,500 hunters, we harvested 504 animals, about 15% success. And this year we're recommending it on the following 8 units: Chalk Creek, Henry Mountains, Pine Valley, West Desert Vernon, West Desert Tinnick, South Slope Yellowstone, Morgan South Rich, and East Canyon. On the private lands only permits, this slide was really interesting. If you remember, more severe winter this year, more conflict with elk, and we sold about the same number of permits last year where we had a lighter winter, less conflict. Our harvest success doubled. So last year with a lighter winter, we had about 22% success on these private lands only permits. This year with a harder winter, more conflict, private landowners were able to harvest the right elk in the right areas to reduce that conflict, and we ended up about 44% harvest success. That's interesting. Here are the private lands only permits that are being recommended for this year. So on the Box Elder East, new hunt there with 200. Beaver East, a new hunt there recommending 100. Central Mountains Manti recommending an increase. Central Mountains Nebo, where that's well below the population objective, recommending a decrease. A new hunt on the Fillmore Oak Creek on the limited entry portion of that, and recommending an increase on the LaSalle's for private lands only. North Slope West Daggett recommending a decrease. Ogden recommending an increase. Santa Fe recommending a new hunt there with 20 permits, and then South Slope Bonanza Vernal recommending an increase there. Recommending an increase on the West Desert Tinnick Valley. This hunt used to just encompass the Vernon portion of the unit, and now it encompasses the Tinnick portion as well, so it's a name change too. And then recommending an increase on the Zion. Overall increase from 9105 to 9785. Pronghorn recommendations. Recommending a slight increase from 2018 for pronghorn permits from 645 to 760. And then by unit. So on the Beaver, where we've had a population build there, recommending a new hunt and 50 permits. Reductions in the Box Elder and Cache, Morgan, Southridge, Ogden. New hunt on the Central Mountains, where we've had a group of pronghorn cross and establish a new population. Next, on the Manti. recommending an increase in the Fillmore. We've had a population really build there. And then a reduction on Mount Dutton-Ponsagot. Also an increase on the North Slope. I have a population to doing well there. Increases on the Panguitch Lake Zion Plateau, Parker Mountain, and South Slope. And recommending a decrease on the Santa Fe North. On to antlerless moose recommendations. Very slight increases of two permits on the Ogden and Ogden West. To go from 34 to 38. And that's all.
Thank you. Questions from the public on the presentation? Come up to the mic, state your name. Colby likes hugs if you want to give him one.
I'm Braden Anderson from Nibley, Utah. So I have been hunting on the cache, the elk unit, for most of my life, and it seems like the elk numbers are not at the point to which the population estimate was at. Every year for the past few years, it seems like there's less and less elk, and I have to go farther and hunt a lot harder and a lot longer to see the same amount of elk on the whole unit as I did just a few years ago. So I'm just trying to figure out where the increase in cow tags and the population estimate is coming from.
Okay.
Jim Christensen, cache district biologist. We were able to fly that unit this year to be able to find those elk. The cache unit is a big unit. It goes from I-15 in Box Elder County to the Idaho state line over to the Wyoming state line. So those elk are spread out across that entire unit. We did have excellent survey conditions. We were able to find elk all across the unit, and we felt very comfortable with our population estimates based off our known counts, and then recommended some increases accordingly.
Okay. How many of those elk are Idaho before you go sit down back and forth from Idaho on the North Cache?
It's hard to say. There are 300 to 500 elk that could bounce back and forth. But this past year during the hunt, I guess the other part other than the flight this year, we've been putting on GPS collars the last two winters. It's been interesting this year. The majority of those elk that can jump back and forth between Idaho and Utah stayed in Utah, back on the edge of the wilderness area, back behind Beaver Mountain, Tony Grove area. And so they just hung tight in there. As anyone who knows that area knows, that's a long walk back in there. In fact, I talked to some hunters who were wondering the same question, where's the elk? And I told them where to go, and they said, do you know how far that is? I said, yeah, that's why the elk are there. So they're in there. They're just hiding.
Thank you. Yep. I don't know if that's the answer you like, but hopefully that answered your question.
Well, and just what was the gentleman's name again?
Braden,
what I'd like to say is one of the things that we've learned in managing elk is that when you tell me you don't see as many elk or elk we're used to, I believe you. I just want you to know that, because the thing we've learned with managing elk is that they change due to pressure and their habits change, and you don't always see them where you used to, and they do go further or different, or and it's, they're just so different than deer. They're not ubiquitous, and sometimes you'll hunt an area where you've seen elk for 15 years and you go in there and there's not a one there. And so it's accurate. That comment's accurate. I've seen it myself.
Any other questions from the public? Questions from the back? Mike.
Colby, back to your San Juan increase in doe permits, targeting the deer that are in Monticello. Is there a boundary, a defined boundary that keeps them from hunting anywhere other than where the deer are a problem?
Yeah, it's the city limit boundary.
When they're hunting within the city limits?
Yeah, that literally is the boundary.
Thank you for the clarification.
We just clipped the city limits and said, go
there
for
you
it.
Go. Mm-hmm. Good enough. Thanks.
with high-powered rifles and scopes?
It's Monticello, man.
Can you shoot? Yeah.
As long as you write yourself permission.
I have a question. This maybe is more for Jim, but you talked about survey conditions when you went out to fly for elk. And wouldn't you find more if you had better survey conditions? Do you take that into account when you're doing your calculations of what you think the population estimate is?
Yes, so Jim Christensen. Yeah, so with the better snow conditions and the survey conditions, our sightability goes up, and so we don't have to estimate as many extra onto there. And so with the snow, elk stand out better, they group up better. And so, yeah, our sightability was a lot higher.
Okay, so that is factored in.
Right, yeah.
Okay, yep. Thank you.
I'm going to wait till Jim sits down and ask him another question. Go ahead.
This is just more for my information, I think. In the central unit, West Desert.
Yes.
You'd put that in there because you weren't managing for elk. So these are elk that have moved into that area on their own. Is there a conflict with landowners, or why would we not want to leave them?
Limited resources and not a population objective. So we're not managing for it. A lot of this overlaps the Vernon Deer Unit. And in a lot of the state, we have the resources for both elk and deer. But when we get into these desert units that are a lot of years have a lot of drought, and then stack elk on top of deer, it can really hurt the deer.
Go ahead.
When you were talking about the studies of the deer and why you set the doe numbers, do you ever use any genetic analysis in that? Like inbreeding?
Yeah. We haven't, not that I'm, can't we have a genetic component to, no, we haven't looked at that.
I have a herd of probably 200 to 300 on private ground above Camas, and they're getting a little worse looking every year. They turn to walk away from me, and they like they're made out of paper. They just disappear. They're about thick. Wonder if, being a livestock operator,
yeah.
I think I would call the whole herd to start over. But so I just wonder if genetics had any. Some of those are getting so they live there year round, and so I'm assuming they're
the same bucks and the same does. Yeah, I'm sure that there are areas where that's a possibility.
Other questions? Troy? That's the only comment card we have from the public. Anybody else wants to comment? Comment? Yeah, just grab one of those cards. Oh, you already did? Sorry, what was your name?
I was here. I was the first one in.
Sorry, you're next.
Troy Justinson, Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. We support the division's recommendations with the following exception, and that being the beaver. We'd ask that we stay with the 2018 permit numbers on the cow. And the reason being is sometimes less is more. We've got a good, we're working on improving our relationship with the permit holders down there, the ag world, and trying to focus on where these cows are being killed. And kind of our thought is the more tags we issue, the success rate goes down. So we'd like to keep that at last year's permit numbers. Thank you.
Greg.
I'm Greg Pine. I'm the operator of the Mountaintop CWMU. I'm definitely not a public speaker, so I'm probably going to pass out or throw up here, but I'll try to get through this.
Kobe will catch you.
So you might want to watch out up there, but. So I got a text from Ken Clegg today, and I'd just like to read a little bit of that. Ken Clegg here, I attended the Central RAC meeting last night and was made aware of an East Canyon alarming issue. The DWR is proposing an increase in private doe hunts from 200 to 1,000 in that area. Mother Nature hunted the does for us this year, and that is a ridiculously high proposed increase. I get most of my data from Ken, and as Cubby, oh no, that's later, hold on. So the collared study in Camas, in the Camas area, 8 of the 10 collared deer have died this winter. That's an 80% death. Add with the drought that we had last year, I've been up on mountaintop since 98, and last year was the worst drought I've ever seen up there. We add the winter that we had. Park City is saying that they had 200% of snowfall this year. With this type of winter and the drought right before it, according to Ken, we will tip, and this is where Covey is also mentioned, we'll probably see less than a 50% survival rate on the adult deer this from coming out of this winter. And the biologist, or I don't know if it's the biologist or whoever is recommending this increase, that's a 400% increase in the amount of does. The other numbers I saw were 10, 30. They're asking 800 does in this area. Ken did a count on my CWMU last year. He counted 354 deer, or about 20 per section. Ken said that's a good solid number. It's not high, it's not low. He predicts this year's count, which we'll do coming up here, spring and summer, he predicts because of the winter and the drought that that will be down to about 10 to 15 deer per section. My observations being up there, so 21 years I've been on that CWMU, not as the operator, but I don't have any of the technical data, you know, the figures and the calculations. What I have personally seen is that, yes, we're seeing more deer, but we're getting back to where the deer used to be, not an over 400% increase in deer. They're asking for 2,720 doe permits, an increase of 765 statewide, and 800 of those are coming from me, my area, the East Canyon area. So Ken's alarmed. I'm alarmed. I don't understand the 400% increase where other areas of the state are 5-10% increase. And we'd just like to, you know, we hope we make this decision based on science, not on society's, you know, input on it. Thanks for your
Thank
time.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Jim?
We don't recognize you guys when you clean up. You clean up pretty good.
Jim Christensen, Cache District Biologist. I'm also the Assistant Wildlife Manager over the Northern Region. And so this was a recommendation made by Eric Anderson. He's not able to be here tonight. So I'll try and explain the best I can his recommendation. So prior to this winter, we did make these recommendations. We were over 2,000 deer over objective on that unit. It is a private lands unit. It's extremely difficult to get the harvest we need. Best ways to have healthy deer herds is to harvest does, and we should have been harvesting does long before now, and the high mortality this winter just shows the need for doe harvest, because we can either let hunters harvest them or we can let the winter kill them. And so this was part of the reason going into it. The other reason for the increase, 500 of these permits are private lands only. Therefore, the private landowner can allow somebody to access and harvest those deer, or he can allow not to. And so the actual permits going to the public to hunt on public ground is only, if I remember right, only like 200 permits. The rest are either archery only or archery only and private lands only, and then the majority of them are on the private lands only side. So that's kind of the reasoning behind there. We do recognize that we are getting some adult mortality, but still it is healthy for deer to be at the range can carry, it's called the carrying capacity. It can only hold so many deer at the time of hardest conditions or hardest living conditions for them. So, you know, to have the healthiest deer herd, we want to be at half of that, and we're above currently.
Yeah.
So where do these deer on that unit winter? How far do they? Is it close or far?
I don't know how to answer that one, other than I do know that we get some moving over onto the Davis face, the Wasatch Front face. But as far as the rest of the unit, I'm not sure on that.
Randy Wood, Wildlife Manager for the Northern Region. If I could add just one thing, too. He has an archery only permits designed on the Davis County side. We experience a lot of deer going into the cities, the urban interface. So not only are we about 3,000 a deer over objective, and we want to pull that down for all the things that Jim talked about, we do experience quite a bit of depredation. So it is kind of some social stuff too that tied in when we make these recommendations. We are over objective. And the other side of the social part of it is those deer that are dropping down into the cities along the front there on the Davis County side.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of it similar to when you guys issue the antlerless elk tags on the private lands only. The landowners control it out of those 500. You could have 30 killed, or you could have, I guess, a couple hundred, but if the landowner's not going to let them in, they're not going to get killed. So, go ahead.
Question. So, as you talked, Randy, as you talked about the deer on the Wasatch Front or on the bench there, you know, I know there was a lot happening with urban deer transplant, and then last year I know the numbers dropped considerably. I think we went from trying to do 200. Transplant 200 deer to 50 last year. My number might have even been lower than that. Is that for price or how much it was cost per purpose, or because if we increase the doe permits, could that not have helped augment that number, not to have so many doe permits? And maybe, or I guess if you're transplanting them, I may have just answered my own question actually.
Yeah,
let's move them somewhere else.
Well, so this was something I was hoping not to address tonight, but I will. So thanks, Justin. But there, in everything we do, there's risk reward associated with that. You know, when we do transplants, really the goals of the transplant is to introduce a new population, augment a struggling population, or reestablish, you know, a population. But there are definitely risks every time you transplant wildlife. Every time you transplant wildlife, you take the risk of moving exotic lice, which we found in these cities, and moving that out to our wild populations. You take the risk of moving chronic wasting disease. You know, we know we have chronic wasting disease in the state, and I would hate to be the biologist that moved it 30 miles. And so it's not something that, you know, we received a public demand to do this and a lot of pressure. We did it. We studied it. We realized that about half of the animals survive. You know, natural adult doe survival is about 85% on average west-wide. And when you move them, about 50% survive. And then the next year, it does bump back up. But as an agency, urban deer transplants are probably something that we're going to move away from in the future. We would still keep the option to transplant deer open if there's a real need to reestablish the population, but to move deer just to move deer, it's pretty dangerous.
Thank you. Go ahead. We're comments and motions after.
So I spend a lot of time out in the woods in the winter, and I was concerned this year too with the deer and the elk. I don't know that a coyote starved to death this winter. Where I hunted, the snow was deeper than I've ever seen it. With that being said, those are things that are out of our control, you know, the snow and that. And I had a lot of concern. I looked at the East Canyon one. I want to thank the biologists for coming and clearing some of those questions up. It made it clearer for me. But I trust that the biologists are doing the best they can and have made these recommendations within the plan. And I'm for all of them.
Any other comments and or motions?
Make a motion that we accept the division's plan for antlerless statewide.
As presented.
As presented.
I'll second that.
Got a motion by John, second by Aaron. Accept the division's plan as presented. Discussion on the motion. All in favor? Okay, it's unanimous. Thank you. Cody, thanks for raining on Justin's parade. He's sad now. Sorry, Mike, you're up.
Okay. So Mike Wardle, and Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator. I'll be presenting our recommended changes to the CWMU program. This is Rule R657-37. First, I want to start out just talking about the overall goals of the CWMU program. First and foremost, it's to increase wildlife resources on private land, and that's by providing, and we do that by providing a monetary incentive for landowners to manage their land in a way that's healthy for wildlife. Another major goal and benefit of the program is that we work to provide public access to private lands for hunting. And then we also want to give protections to the landowners who allow that access. Before I get into the individual recommendations, I want to make it clear that these recommendations they're not changing anything at the heart of the program. The CWMU program is a very successful program. It's built a lot of good relationships, especially here in the northern region. And so we're not making any changes to the type of species that can be hunted, acreage requirements, permit allocation, any of that. And with that, I'll get into our recommended changes. So we put in some language dealing with agricultural damage, both within a CWMU and adjacent to it. For damage within a CWMU, we input wording that would require landowners and lessees, when they sign up for the CWMU program, they would be waiving their rights to any depredation assistance through our depredation program. The goal is to keep the two programs separate and to not have them merge and have landowners taking from both of those programs. And then for damage adjacent to a CWMU, we want CWMUs to explain upfront in the management plan how they plan to avoid, mitigate, and if necessary, compensate negative impacts to their neighbors. We're recommending some changes to items that deal with a CWMU Certificate of Registration, or COR. So in the current rule, if a CWMU has their land ownership, just the ownership, if that changes more than 33% within a given year, that CWMU is automatically terminated and then they have to reapply. We haven't really seen that happen, and so we decided to remove that out of the rule, or recommending to remove that out of the rule. With variance renewals, currently if a CWMU receives a variance to the minimum acreage standards, for example, under the current rule, they have to go back and request that variance from our CWMU advisory committee every 3 years, regardless of if they change or not. And it's fairly redundant, and so we'd like to remove that. And the new language states that if there is any attempt to decrease acreage, or you know, if they have a non-contiguous variance, if they attempted to add another non-contiguous parcel, that would then void their current variance, and they'd have to go back. But if they're not making any changes, it seems redundant to pull them before the committee every 3 years. And then also we have put wording stating that CWMUs may only have one hunt boundary, and that even if there's multiple species, they can't have differing boundaries for different species. And we also added satisfaction ratings to items that the Wildlife Board can consider when they're trying to determine whether to renew a CWMU or not. And then we also put in direction for our biologists on what we need to be considering when we're allocating permits to CWMUs. So we put in the following items. We look at acreage and habitat conditions, management objectives, classification and survey data, depredation and nuisance conflicts, and other factors that can influence hunt quality. This is currently what we do in practice, but we wanted to provide that direction in rule. With the operation of a CWMU, we expanded the Landowner Association member definition to include CWMU employees, agents, and volunteers. And then we also defined that management buck permits are only available on a CWMU if that CWMU lies within a management unit where there is currently a public management buck hunt occurring. And we also standardized the muzzleloader elk season to match the standard 61-day season. And then on to how a CWMU operates. We put some strong language stating that hazing wildlife is not allowed on a CWMU, and the only time that it is if a CWMU is issued a certificate of registration from the Division of Wildlife. There are times when we ask a CWMU to haze in order to mitigate conflicts with neighboring landowners. That's one of the most useful tools, in all honesty, in preventing damage. And there are times when we ask CWMUs to do that, but if they're not given permission to do that, they're not allowed to. And also with areas of a CWMU that are excluded from hunting, what this looks like in practice is a CWMU is open to hunting throughout the entire property, but they may have a cabin that they don't want hunters around, both private or public hunters. If they want an area closed like that, that has to be stated up front in the management plan, and they can't do it mid-season. And then also we put some sideboards on reciprocal agreements. These are agreements between CWMU operators that allow their hunters to hunt multiple CWMUs. Any funds that are generated from an agreement like that can only be spent on certain items such as classification and teeth aging, and that's already managed through rule. But we put in the sideboard that written approval from the Division of Wildlife must be given on how those funds are spent, and then we require an annual report every year. Then with our CWMU advisory committee, we gave them the ability in rule to place a CWMU on probation. And we spelled out what probation looks like. This would simply be that a CWMU is placed on corrective action. They have to provide the committee with a written plan and report annually to them. I want to make it clear that any formal action would still have to be taken by the Wildlife Board. And then we also made a lot of rule technical changes, and we reorganized some of the rule to try and make it, we tried to remove stuff that was redundant and try and simplify it a little bit. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC? I don't think we have any comment.
We do?
Oh. We don't have no comments from the public. Comments and or motions from the RAC?
accept the plan as presented.
Make a motion that we accept the plan as presented. Okay. Sorry, Jody.
We'll second it.
Got a motion from Mike, a second from Justin. Accept the division's proposal or presentation as presented. Discussion on the motion. All in favor? It's unanimous. Moving right along.
All right, you got me for two more. But at least my stuff's quicker than Kobe's, right? So, I'll also be presenting our 2019 CWMU antlerless permit recommendations. We had a total of 26 CWMU applications that contained antlerless permits come in for the 2019 hunting season. Two of those were new CWMU applications. There was 11 renewals and 13 changes. Just to give a brief overview of how this works, most of us are familiar with this, but the left side of this slide shows the split options for buck and bull permits. When a CWMU signs into the program, we discuss and make a recommendation on what that split will be. If you look at like the 90-10 split there on the top, if a CWMU chooses the 90-10 split, they automatically get the split on the right side for antlerless permits. So, you know, if a CWMU has a 90-10 elks or 90-10 split on an elk CWMU, they would receive 90% of those permits and 10% would go through the public draw. But then when we issue antlerless permits, 100% of those go through the public draw. And what that has created is a lot of opportunity for antlerless hunting on the CWMUs. This slide shows the summary of our vouchers and permits that we're recommending for 2019 by species. The number that I draw your attention to is that bottom right-hand corner, and that's over 1,100 hunters that are allowed hunting on private land, that will be allowed hunting on private land next year. Before I get into the individual changes, I want to just explain some of our justification of why we recommend changes on CWMUs. A lot of times we're looking at wildlife distribution. As we know, wildlife don't distribute themselves evenly across the landscape, and that comes even more into play when you're looking at smaller units. And CWMUs are typically smaller than our bigger wildlife management units. We're also looking at any kind of change in acreage and the type of opportunity the type of habitat that is offered on the unit. We're also looking at quality and management objectives. And when we recommend to add a new hunt, we're trying to utilize an available resource. So with that, I'll get into the new applications. We had a new application in the central region. The CWMU is called Mountain Sky Ranch. We're recommending antlerless elk permits there. This is up Spanish Fork Canyon. In the southern region, we have a new CWMU. It's called Heist, and we're recommending doe pronghorn permits there. This is near Enterprise out west of Cedar City. I'll get into the renewal applications. For the northern region, I'm just going to touch on the changes, and if we have questions, we can go back and talk about individual ones. Here in the northern region for the renewals, we're recommending an increase in two doe permits on the Junction Valley CWMU and a new doe pronghorn permit on the Rabbit Creek CWMU. In the northeastern region, we're recommending antlerless elk permits on the West Willow Creek Ranch. In the southeastern region, no changes there on JB Ranch. In the southern region, we're recommending to decrease antlerless elk permits on the grazing pasture CWMU. With all renewals, with that, I'll get into the change applications. So these are CWMUs who are already currently within their three-year COR that we're recommending a change to the permits that were previously approved. You'll see here in the northern region, we have a healthy request for increases on antlerless elk permits. We sat down with the advisory committee and a handful of CWMUs to discuss how the CWMUs could better help us reach our objectives, and they've responded favorably in helping us. And so with that, we're recommending increases on the Deseret, Grass Valley Clark Canyon, Mountaintop, Two Bear, and Weber Florence Creek CWMUs. In the central region, we're recommending a decrease in antlerless elk permits on the Heaston East and we're recommending to have antlerless elk permits for the first time on Double R Ranch. In the southeastern region, we're recommending to decrease antlerless elk permits on Indian Head, Jump Creek, and Rhone Cliffs, and then recommending to increase antlerless elk tags on Schofield Canyons and Spring Creek Dodge. And in the southern region, we're recommending to decrease antlerless elk permits on the Pavant and Zion CWMU. And that's what I have. Thank you.
Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC on the presentation? Melissa?
Can you go back to the Deseret? Okay, thank you. And this is, can you remind me, this is for antlerless?
Yes, these are antlerless elk.
The dates, when these people apply for these hunts, are the dates on the proclamation set already as they put in for them?
So there are, sometimes on the hunt planner we'll have that, you know, the public hunts are typically held during this time, but an operator can't specify you're only allowed this weekend or whatever on the CWMU. So the dates are posted of, you know, this hunt is available. You know, some of these antlerless elk hunts, it might be August 1st to the end of January. And the public hunter has the ability to choose in that time frame. So, and for deer, you know, if a CWMU has hunting that goes into the first week in November, part of our rules states that the public hunter has to be allowed that opportunity if November hunting is happening on the CWMU. So we don't specifically state their dates because we want there to be communication between the operator and the public hunter on that.
How has that been received as far as comments from public hunters as to do with dates and being allowed to go in there?
I think for those who communicate with the operators, it works really well. For the guy that gets a tag and doesn't think to call the operator until the day before he wants to hunt, it doesn't work as well.
And they're the vocal ones that
right.
we hear yep. about, correct?
Yep. And we have the advisory committee and that we vet those through.
I make the motion that we accept the presentation as presented. Okay. Got a motion to accept as presented from Mike. Second from Kevin. Discussion on the motion. All in favor? It's unanimous. As Chris just pointed out, she said that the division's doing a good job. I want to second her on that. There's not a lot of people here complaining about what's going on in Utah, so I applaud all the division. I think they're doing a great job.
It's the white shirts.
It's the white shirts.
Have white hats next time.
That's right.
Yeah.
Are you ready for me, Mr. Chair?
Sorry, go ahead.
Okay.
I'm just
you're good.
Writing and not paying attention.
You're good. So I'll also be presenting our recommended changes to our big game depredation rule. So we're recommending changes to some definitions. We want to expand the damage incident period definition to our entire fiscal year, which is July 1st through June 30th. Typically, it was just a 90-day period. And that sometimes depredation occurs longer than 90 days in a lot of scenarios. And we also put in a definition for what we call a depredation mitigation plan. This is the document that we go out and fill out with landowners when damage is occurring that outlines what actions we're going to take and how we're going to help alleviate the damage. And we included a definition for what we consider to be an immediate family member. You can see that there. And then we expanded the mitigation permit definition to allow a landowner's immediate family member or employees to receive mitigation permits. And then we also include, or we put in new definitions to describe what we consider a landowner and lessee to be. With pronghorn permits, we'd like to match what we do with mule deer and have two doe pronghorn permits available in the depredation program. And then also remove the same language that Covey presented about earlier, removing language that stated an individual cannot have both a doe pronghorn and a buck pronghorn permit in the same year. Two doe permits really help us a lot with public depredation hunts. And there's a lot of times when we go to a landowner and we say, you know, we need to remove 20 doe pronghorn in order to alleviate your problem, and the landowner says, well, I'm not going to allow 20 people on my fields to come hunt these does. And with this option, we can say, well, would you allow 10 that have two doe permits, and we can still accomplish the same amount. And we also gave direction and spelled out what we call our appeal process in rule. This matches practice, but it wasn't clear in rule, and so we input language that talks about stop kill orders. This is when a landowner has the right to issue what we call a 72-hour notice, where they give 72 hours notice to the Division of Wildlife, and within those after those 72 hours are up, they have the legal right to remove wildlife themselves. And if the value of that wildlife is the same or exceeding the damage that is actually occurring, the director's office has the ability to issue what's called a stop kill order, making that 72-hour notice null and void. And so we spelled that out in rule greater, and then also talked about the appeal process for if a landowner does not agree with our mitigation plan that has been presented. And that is all I have. Thank you.
Questions from the public? Questions from the RAC?
I have one.
Okay.
Are the number of, like, the permits that I've been getting, I can only allow two different names for my permits. Is that still in effect, or?
Are you talking for elk?
Elk deer.
Permits, for deer permits? So.
I guess both.
Yeah, so when you say you can only allow two different names, you mean if you're given five permits, you're only able to put two names on those five permits? Now, you could have five different people on all five of those permits with our current rule, and that would still be the same.
It's good to know.
You weren't paying attention. Comments from the public? We don't have any cards. Comments? And no motions.
I'll make the motion that we accept as presented.
Second.
Discussion on the motion? All in favor? Unanimous.
Thank you.
Chairman?
Yes.
I don't know that we can go back on an issue, but I made a slight note here back on, I believe it was the bulls. Permits, SFW made a recommendation to stay at a certain number on, I believe it was the Monroe, due to some issues with landowner relationships that they were working on. I don't know that I think we skipped over that, and I was wanting a little more information on that. Is it proper to go back and clarify that, or do we have to leave it?
On the beaver, because that's probably the one they're talking about.
What it was, Charlie?
I don't. Yeah, I don't see why we can't.
Wildlife boards re-voted after they voted several times, so why can't we?
Yeah, just chunking out a separate motion on, I guess, back to item number 6. So. Troy, do you want to make some clarification on what you guys are asking for on the beaver? And turn your phone off.
My mother wishing me a late happy birthday, which she forgot about. Can you believe that?
Happy 60th birthday,
Troy. You're 51 years old. Holy cow, man.
No, basically what it was is on the cow permits on the beaver that we'd like you to keep them at 2018 numbers, just for the simple fact without more permits, our success rate went down. And we got, we're working on a good relationship with the permittees there to designate where these cows are harvested, to try to move them around. So we're fine either way. We appreciate you going back to it, but we can address it down the line like you talked about. So.
The top of your head, what was 18 and 19?
It's like 100 permits. I want to say it was 900 permits, and last year was 800, I think is what it was. I can't remember off the top of my head. Once again, the birthday factor coming in.
Return next year and let us know how it worked. And yeah. Can you remember that?
I might.
If you want, we can revisit, or I can make a note and pass that along to the Wildlife Board to say we didn't make a motion, but on a side note, we had concerns that we kind of skipped through it, but I can make that recommendation, or I can make that note just on a side note to the Wildlife Board.
Okay, yeah, that would work. I just, we got a lot of information going on there, and I made a note, and I was going to mention it and didn't.
Okay, awesome.
Couldn't we make a motion that is friendly to our previous motion? I can't remember the wording. But I think we could do another motion on that. I think, because it doesn't negate what we already agreed to.
I don't have a problem. We can either, like I said, we have two options.
I'm happy. I'm satisfied with the option that it just be a note to the board from you as the chair.
I will do that.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Justin Shannon, that waltzes in late like he owns the place, we'll turn the time over to you.
Okay, thank you. My name is Justin Shannon. I'm the wildlife section chief, and my mom has never forgot my birthday. And tonight, I'm going to present the conservation permit rule revision. let's see, how do I see this? There we go. One thing that we're looking to do initially is, as part of this rule revision, is move the entire conservation permit program to a three-year process. How it currently works is we have three-year conservation permits, and those are applied for once every 3 years and obtained and distributed through the conservation groups. And then we also have a one-year conservation permit process, and we have conservation permits that are set aside for these groups that may enter the program, and they can do that on an annual basis. And what we're looking to do is establish one single application process that would occur once every 3 years, and it would streamline the conservation permit program and simplify the processes associated with it. With that, we define eligibility requirements for a conservation organization, and we would allow up to two new conservation organizations into the program each term. In the event that we had more than two apply and they were all eligible, we would select them via a random draw. In addition to simplifying the program, it would ensure that all the conservation permits that are available would be used, because those ones that are set aside for the one-year program, if we don't have a one-year program applying for them like this year, they don't get used for conservation. New groups that apply, as they're accepted in the program, their first term, they would be placed on probation, and they would receive 0.5% of the market share from the other participating groups. And market share is an interesting concept. Essentially what that is it's essentially all the conservation permits equal a pie, they equal a number, and your market share is what portion of that pie you receive. And so if hypothetically, the conservation permit program was worth $1 million, and a conservation organization had $100,000 worth of permit, they would have 10% of the market share. And so new groups coming in would receive a market share at 0.05% from the other groups that are currently in the program. In addition to that, new groups would have to maintain a minimum of 75% of their market share. and actively market permit opportunities and complete all reporting as specified in the rule. And if they do that, and at the end of their term, the division has the ability to determine if a group meets these requirements of their probationary status, and if they do, they can successfully move on and forward into the program. We also realized the conservation permit rule really didn't have a provision or address what would happen if a conservation permit organization left the program and wanted to come back in, and so we addressed that with this rule revision. And so moving forward, if a conservation permit organization leaves in good standing, they can come back at the beginning of the next three-year term. They can apply again at the next three-year term, and if they're accepted, they could participate at the market share they had before they left the program. Does that make sense? For scheduling, we're proposing an August 15th deadline for all the participating organizations. And once every 3 years, conservation permit organizations would have to submit their applications to reapply every year, or every cycle, every term. And then on an annual basis, they will have had to have sold their permits, reported, and transferred all the funds to the division by August 15th. In the past, this deadline was September 1st. We felt like administratively we needed a little bit more time to review these applications and for the auditing processes that occur. One thing we added in addition to that is that vouchers cannot be purchased or redeemed by officers, agents, directors, or employees of a participating conservation organization unless those vouchers are purchased at 100% of the three-year average. The idea behind this is that the goal of the conservation permit program is to generate as much revenue as possible for conservation, and so we thought that was important. We also want to clarify that the conservation permits are approved in a separate process than that of the public draw permit. So like tonight when Kobe presented and Mike Wardle presented, these are public draw permits, and the conservation permits would be approved in its own process. It would be brought to the RACSM board. We also wanted to align the voucher redemption process with the electronic application. What this means and what this is referring to is moving forward, all the organizations are currently using an electronic application to record and track every conservation permit voucher. And in the past, they had receipts that they'd have to tear off and different things like that. And because we're not using that anymore, we eliminated a lot of that language. Also, we'd require that all the information on winning bidders needs to be entered in the electronic app before a permit is issued. And then finally, we clarify, similar to what Kobe brought forth earlier, that a person can obtain a conservation permit for both a desert bighorn ram and a Rocky Mountain bighorn ram in a single year. And we've also strengthened some administrative enforcement language and other housekeeping items. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Questions from the public on the... Troy.
I was just kidding about the birthday track.
I'll bet you.
Troy Justin, the Sportsman Fish and Wildlife. Justin, can you elaborate? I'm not real comfortable with the paragraph you had in there about employees, officers or whatever. I mean, in all our auctions, everything is at our banquets. It's a public auction amongst hundreds of people. The whole goal of our groups is to raise amount of money as we possibly can. But to really handicap an individual, if a tag's going, you know, a little bit below a three-year average, I don't fully understand what you're trying to accomplish there. And quite honestly, I don't think it's fair.
The idea behind that and what we're trying to accomplish is...
Will you go back to that page just
real
quick?
This one? Is that where... Yeah, what we're trying to do is we're trying to emphasize that the purpose of the conservation permit program is to generate as much revenue as possible. It's not to find a smoking good deal on a cheap permit. And I understand what Troy's saying. It may be difficult, especially if they're at an auction and a permit's going for low. I understand that, but we're just trying to avoid the appearance of any type of wrongdoing if by having officers get these permits that were intended to raise revenue. So that's the why behind it. So.
Kevin, question.
It does say unless purchased at 100% of the three-year average. So it still does allow them to purchase, but it has to be at that level. Is that what I'm reading?
Yeah, so they can purchase a conservation permit. That's not the issue. But what we're looking at is if you had a San Juan bull elk tag that typically goes for $15,000, hypothetically, I'm not sure. We'd want that permit to be purchased. If an officer of a conservation organization is going to purchase it, they should purchase it at $15,000 or above is kind of what we're saying. But Troy brings up some good points, though. It could be difficult. How do you know what each permit goes for if you're on there? And that'd be one of the downsides.
So, I mean, say they bought it for $10,000. The three-year average is $15,000.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, it's $5,000. They don't know that. Well, maybe they might have an idea, but they don't know that during the auction.
Yeah.
And they buy that, then what do you... You either say you either pay the $15,000 or we're going to re-auction it. I mean, the only thing it hurts is their group. It hurts their rating.
It does. The consequence is it hurts their market share. But it's more of a perception issue. You know, what we're trying to avoid is an officer in a conservation organization getting these permits that are supposed to be distributed to raise as much revenue as they can. And if it turns out they got an awesome deal, people could look at that and say, hold on, I don't know if that appears right. It's the optics that we're interested in.
So, no. Justin and Mike.
I got a really good point. He just bought it at the highest bid. So that means if he doesn't buy it, it's going for cheaper. So that
you've lost your three-year average.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's
so if he's the highest bidder and doesn't get it, it makes no sense that we're going to go ahead and sell it for cheaper because this person...
Sure.
Has that ever even happened?
Yeah. No. I mean, this is all about, this is more a comment than a question. Mm-hmm. Every year you hear people bitch about this. Sorry, probably shouldn't abuse that term.
So define an officer.
This is about,
who is
I'm
dying
this
to
is
hear
about
this.
Perception, though. I mean, if you have an organization, any organization, in charge of raising money, and then somebody in that organization gets a killer deal on something.
But it doesn't have to be a killer deal. What he's saying is if it's not the three-year average. If you do it in front of 400 people and you have 400 witnesses that say you participated in purchases of a tag, that's still not adequate. I think it questions the integrity of the groups. And with the amount of money that's gone back into the state through the groups, I have a little bit of a question about that myself, to be honest with you.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I would agree. How many times has this happened?
Yeah, I mean, is this an ongoing...
In the last 5 years, how many times has this happened?
I we didn't go back and quantify it. And it's not because it's been this major problem. To be really candid, it's just the optics of it. There's a lot of people, like Randy was saying, that could be... Yeah, go ahead.
There's people that are always going to complain. They have no right to complain because there's... In my opinion, I'd like to see if this has ever happened. If it's never happened... They're complaining about nothing. I don't know.
It has happened. But I couldn't tell you how many times over the last 5 years.
So is the perception happened. When somebody's bidding for someone else is that that's an officer of the company? Because that happens every week. It's not always the officer of the company that's buying the tag that can be bidding for someone else almost entirely.
Yeah, that's it. And that's a fair point, Mike. So you're saying if you have a bidder on the phone?
So the perception is, Troy can attest to this. Guy gives you a number. He's not there. He says... Take it to this, and you do. We're not officially buying the tag. It's for Joe Blow down the street that he's bought tags with us before. Turns out there's only 150 people in the room that night as opposed to the 250 from last year. The guy gets a better deal. It's an officer of the company that just made the purchase. That may be the area that you focus your attention. Maybe the officer of the company hands those bidders off to someone else for the perception.
Sure. Yep.
I've personally seen Troy at a banquet on the phone bidding on a tag, and I know dang well he's not spending $70,000 or $80,000 of his own money buying a tag. He's your mom didn't give you your birthday money. He's bidding on that tag for somebody out of state.
Yeah.
Granted, I see the perception, but it's still not him. I think this needs a lot of reworking. Go ahead, Kevin.
Working for government my whole career, I see exactly why the transparency is important. But my question is, what happens to the permit if they are the highest bidder, and it's a smoking deal, and you know it's the highest bid? If we don't sell it to that high bid, what happens to the permit?
How we would treat it is it would probably show up in an audit finding, because we audit all of these permits. I mean, anybody that's involved in the conservation permit program knows how much we look at this, and that's essentially what it would be, because we don't put provisions in the rule that it would be re-auctioned or anything along those lines. In some cases, we might not find out until we look at the audit, and they may have already hunted at that point. So it would be an audit finding. So, yeah.
Just to clarify, I mean, what happens if somebody backs out on a permit and you roll it down two banquets down the road?
Yeah, you can do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's a perception, isn't always everything that's actually true. You know what I mean?
No, this is a good discussion. I mean, this is why we bring these things through a public process. So, I mean, certainly if the RAC feels strongly that this isn't the route we should go, I mean, vote accordingly.
So this is officer, agent, directors, or employees. I mean, is that volunteers? I mean, who is an agent? I mean, how do you determine? Is that a chair of a committee?
No, it's not a volunteer. It's an officer where they're like a CEO or something along those lines, or an agent where their duties are to oversee the conservation permit program. A director, I think that's self-explanatory. An employee, if you're getting paid by that organization. So that's, volunteers, certainly no. There's a lot of people to volunteer.
So just instance, last week I had a friend from Richfield call me that was buying tags for outfitters. He says, do you know anybody that's going to be at the MDF banquet in Tremont? Nope, but here's Mike Lauder's number. Call him. You know anybody that's going to be at the SFW dinner in Salt Lake? Nope. Here's Kevin and Troy's number. Call them. So they call these guys to have them, you know, bid on these tags. And I don't know. I don't love the idea of them, because it is perception that these guys are bidding, you know, on them tags for themselves. But in reality, 99% of the time, they're probably not.
Yeah, Bryce, can you appreciate what we're trying to do? We're trying to protect the integrity of the conservation permit program. And if we went about it the wrong way, certainly we can put the brakes on it and have discussions down the road on how to do both, how to not put people in a bind, because that's everything we do has consequences, and sometimes those are unintended consequences. Our purpose, the why behind what we're trying to do, is to make sure that there's no appearance of wrongdoing, because we audit this, we look at these things really, really closely, and the vibe I'm getting is that we missed the mark, and that's good feedback. So,
no, and I appreciate, I mean, what you're after, but the unintended consequences is what I'm afraid of, and I just don't think it's fair to some of these organizations.
So my question is, in that list of officers, agents, directors, and employees, how many of those are there at a mule deer banquet or SFW banquet? How many of them are there? Troy could probably.
Yeah, Mike or Troy could probably ask.
Generally, in our case, one or two. I mean, in a lot of cases, the regional director goes to the event. I'm the director of field operations, so I may attend an event that needs a little extra help. You know what I mean? An extra set of hands. We may bring some volunteers to that.
So my question is to avoid the impression or the appearance of evil, you're only going to talk to two different guys and say, could you get somebody else to bid those tags, right?
So this is one of the things that we may not have thought through very well, because I've been to several of these banquets where these permits are being sold. And it's true. People call and they say, hey, I saw your name online. I know you're associated with this organization.
Yeah.
Can I bid through you? And I don't think the point of this was to tell Mike and Troy and others that they can't bid for someone on the phone. It was more of they can't personally obtain a permit for themselves unless they're willing to pay full market value for it.
Well, sorry, Justin.
Three-year
average. I get three-year average, but Troy and I watch these tags go up and down from year to year.
Correct.
You know, we could see a tag that has a great blooming unit go very well one year, and the next year not so much. And it doesn't meet the three-year average. I mean, but it's competitive with what the 350 or 400 people in the room have dictated for that particular night based on attendance.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It's consistent with what the public that's in the room that night says, but it may not be consistent with the three-year average.
Yeah, no, that's, you're right.
They fluctuate quite frequently.
Yeah, because a unit may decrease in quality. I mean, it might have been really good in 2015, 16, and 17, and now it's not as good thanks to COVID. So,
you know, Justin, I'd like to say I can also understand and appreciate the need for transparency on this issue, because sometimes there's an awful lot of discontent once these auctions have happened. Concern I have as we try to sort of get our arms around it, we really don't have any data. You know, we really can't say that we know this has happened X number of times and therefore we are trying to resolve a significant problem that we've got our arms around.
Sure.
And you know, I mean, it's different than gathering data on a wildlife population and then making your management plan, but still, maybe it's premature because we don't, you know, the intent is good, but extent knowledge of the problem maybe is not there to support the proposal yet.
And I'm going to have to throw something else in. I don't want to be squeaky wheel on this, but when we're talking this kind of money, I mean, these tags go for a lot of money. There has to be some type of procedure in place to give the public confidence that
we're audited every year.
There has to be. No one in this room works for an organization or a company that doesn't have guidelines in place when it comes to exchanging money, gifts, whatever. And I'm not saying these are gifts. But whatever, there has to be something there to give the public confidence that this is an above-the-board process.
So I want to speak to Mike's point real quick, because this is audited every year, and it takes a lot of our time. And we have a fiscal section, and I see the time that they put in to looking through all this. And we publish those reports. We go through that pretty thoroughly. And that's just it. That's why it's hard for me to come to the RAC tonight and say, I can name off like a dozen instances where this has been a major problem. It hasn't. It's just the conservation permit program is under a lot of scrutiny, and we're just trying to make sure the optics look right. And that's what we were trying to accomplish. And so these are good points. This really highlights the value of the public process, because some of the things that you're talking about with somebody standing there on the phone, it's probably not something that us and our attorneys thought of as we're drafting these rules and working through some of this. So,
where they're a state tag, we have to allow access to that permit. And so if you're in Wisconsin and can't make it to Weber Davis or wherever the event happens to be that weekend, there are contact information on them. We've encouraged that.
Correct.
Because we have to provide access to the permit. And in doing so, you take phone calls.
Yep.
But I'm not that familiar with these processes, but it seems like if the issue is the officer, is there somebody else they could hand the phone to? Or with technology, could you put them on speakerphone so that it's just clear it's not the officer bidding, it's somebody else bidding? It seems like there should be a way to do it that way and take the specific individuals, if there are two or three people, and there's hundreds of people there.
Bryce, I got a comment.
But Ben has, and then I'll go to you first. Go ahead, Ben.
I just want to address the question about officers taking the phone calls. I'm the vice president of the Utah Archery Association. I've dealt with a lot of these texts as well. Finding volunteers is hard. And, of course, when we're talking about raising revenue for conservation and for organizations, we want to put these potential bidders in the best hands possible, and a lot of times that is myself or other officers or directors of the organization, and I don't want to hand that off to somebody that I don't trust. if you will. So I would hate to eliminate the possibility to allow myself or my other officers to handle these bids. And also, I don't think the intent here is to not allow an officer to do a phone bid for somebody else, because if I, as an officer, is helping a phone bidder, I'm not the one making the purchase. Even though I'm the one there bidding, officially, I'm not the one making the purchase. It's the person on the other end of the phone, right? So I think we're muddying the weeds a little bit there. And I have some additional comments too, but I'll save that for the comment period. But I wanted to address the officers handling bids. So I hope that was helpful.
Thank you. That was my point. I think that this rule still allows Troy or whoever, whichever organization, to bid for somebody. What this rule, I think, is trying to prohibit is the actual officers from purchasing it for themselves. And I think that's what we need to decide on, this rule change. And correct me if I'm not wrong. You're not trying to prevent Troy or Ben or Mike from bidding for somebody. This rule would prevent them from actually purchasing and receiving the tag. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
But where's all the complaints from?
Yeah, we got the perception. When it was the perception. Sorry.
It's the perception, so that's what, I mean.
I understand that, but at these banquets, you don't have a lot of people that end up complaining. That's my opinion. I don't think that the people that go to the Mule Deer Foundation banquet then complain on the Mule Deer, most likely. Yeah. It's the perception when maybe this comes out in a report, if they see, you know, this president or this officer got two or three tags, that may cause some concern. That's just my take on it.
Would Troy be able to purchase one, or Mike, if Troy went to an MDF banquet and purchased it there? It's not his organization, or vice versa.
Yeah, sure. They can certainly purchase one, but it would have to be at 100% of the three-year average.
So if Mike went to an SFW.
Correct.
And he purchased it, and it was less than the three-year average.
Yes.
How is that fair? It's not even their, but not even their organization.
It's not. But what we're talking about is the purpose of this is not to find great deals on conservation permits for your own benefit.
Yeah.
It's to raise as much money as you can for conservation. And so, if Mike went to Troy's banquet and wanted to bid on this. As an officer of a conservation organization, it doesn't matter which one he's at, he'd have to pay full market share for it.
Doesn't the audit reflect that, Justin? If you guys are looking at the audit, you're looking down and saying, wow, we just sold a San Juan for $5,000.
Right.
Obviously, that's a red flag, okay?
Correct.
If there's, I mean, it's audited, it's looked at by everybody. We have to stay in compliance to even participate in the program. I mean, if there's not red flags, it seems like, I mean, if it's just public perception, then that's what we need to call it.
But again, if we're trying to make as much money as possible, if Troy outbids the other, what we're going to go ahead and do is, if Troy bid $10,000 and the bid before was $9,500, we're going to go ahead and sell it for $9,500 because of perception. And if we're trying to get as much money as possible, we just sold it for cheaper.
I see what you're saying. Like if because Troy has the ability to. This is a fun discussion. Troy has the ability to say 8,000. Someone else says 8,500. He says 9,000. Someone else says 9,500. You ended up selling it for 9,500 because he was bidding on it, and so you're actually getting more money for conservation. I understand the argument.
Well, that's a different. I agree with that too. Right. That's not what I was saying.
Depends on how much his mother gave him for his birthday.
Yeah. Yeah.
How many conservation organizations are we talking about right now?
I think there's six or seven right around there.
If we accept this, does it go in for 3 years? Are we locking it in for 3 years? This, if we accept this tonight?
This rule?
Yes, you mentioned that you want to go in like a three-year cycle. So if we accept this, I'm not saying we are, but do we lock ourselves in for 3 years?
The rule would be in place until we decide to revisit the rule. Yeah. The 3 year cycle is something completely different. So. Yeah.
Question.
So
we're still on questions, right?
Yeah. We're still on questions.
Yeah.
So you look a little bit confused or a little bit hesitant now. I agree with your concept, and I agree with the idea that we need to make things look up and up and on, you know, being out in the vast group of 400 when the conservation permits come up for sale. There's a lot of mumbling and grumbling in the on the back rows of you know, the poor old lay guys that just wish they could get a deer tag and they didn't draw out for the last 2 years and their preference points are building up. and yet here's this Mr. Moneybags from his mom that just bought another deer tag that he could go hunt in December up in the deep snow on the hill above Camas when all the big bucks are up there having their convention. And I mean, you can hear it, and it's I don't know if there's an answer to the complaining, but I think if we come up with a process that makes it look like everything is on the up and up and square and straight, and we have the data that says this is the way it is, why they got no complaint other than people complain about everything anyway.
Yeah.
But if we have facts to prove otherwise, we shouldn't feel bad about that.
Are we on questions? Are we?
Yeah, sorry. That was his early comment. It was supposed to be a question.
Sorry.
So, question?
So that was a preface to a,
okay.
To a motion, man.
Okay. Question.
So I have a question. Would it satisfy your desire if this was worded that they had to pay market price unless it was at an auction?
Yeah, I mean that's actually a pretty fair compromise, because there could be online auctions, there can be some of that, but if I mean one way, this is interesting because John makes the comment that I'm going back and forth. This is the beauty of the public process, is to think through this stuff a little bit better, and these are great points. I think if the RAC wanted to make a motion that said unless it's presented at a public auction via a banquet or something along those lines, where you have, well, I won't get in the weeds, but yeah, if it's at a public banquet, I think we'd be a little bit more comfortable with that.
I would too. I think that's a very good statement. I think that solves the whole discussion. Is if it's at a public, in a public setting, and there are 350 witnesses, then and that's what it goes for, then I think that solves it.
Yeah,
for me.
Okay.
I think that's a fair. Yeah, okay. And that's something that we could live with as well. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any more? We're still on questions. Still on questions. No.
Why are we still on questions? That's my question.
We're going to go from questions to comments from the public. Comments from the public. We have a card from Ben and then Troy.
Thanks, Bryce. Ben Lauder, Utah Archery Association. I do have one more question. I'll follow up. Justin, correct me if I'm wrong. Doesn't the current rule require that all these tags are sold at public auction? I thought we made that change recently. Initially, unless the purchase falls through, that the initial purchase, I thought, was supposed to be done through public auction. Is that not in rule?
It's not. We say that they have to be through an auction, or I'd have to look at the rule a little bit more. But it can be an online auction, it can be a public auction, it can be some of that type of stuff. It doesn't all tie it to a public auction. Some of this is online.
Would that not still be a public auction?
The question was, wouldn't an online auction still be a public auction?
Yeah, I do think they're different, though. I think an online auction has a different... I don't know. Yes, it is a public auction, but I think they're different. I think you're reaching different audiences. I like what Mike said. When you have 350 witnesses there, it's really hard to pull a fast one when there's 350 witnesses there, and that's what we're trying to avoid, is any of that. So,
yep. All right, I'll make my comments now, and I'll try to keep them brief. Utah Archery Association supports the recommendations as presented. I do want to comment briefly, though, on this issue we've been discussing, and I just want to point out, Justin, that if if an officer of an organization is bidding on a tag and ends up purchasing it for the less than the three-year average, you've made several comments tonight about the whole point of the program is to get as much money as possible out of these tags. And if an officer or an employee of an organization is required to meet that three-year average, it's possible that that eliminates them from some of these. Like, they see an opportunity to buy a tag that's going cheap. If they're bidding on it, they're driving that bid up. And if this new rule prevents them from bidding on it, then we're not getting as much as we possibly can out of that tag. So just something to take into consideration. So, but again, we support the recommendations. Thank you.
Okay. Troy?
Troy Justinson, Sports Fish and Wildlife. In full disclosure, I've bought two conservation permits in my whole life, one of which was a swan tag 15 years ago for $250. Then I bought a bonanza antelope for $950. So I am not in the realm you guys are talking about. You know, if I break the $1,000, I'm out. You know, go look at my Chevy truck. You'll know why exactly. But no, I support the division's recommendation except this place. And let me make something perfectly clear. Been involved in this program since day one. And to keep it around and to make sure that we meet public scrutiny, I'll give up my opportunity. But I just don't think it's fair because I know who the perpetrators are. Let's punish them instead of the individuals that work hard to make sure that we dot every I and cross every T. I think it's a great comment to say if it's public auction and I am competing, whoever it is, competing in front of everybody else for the bid, to me, I don't think it's fair saying, all right, you won the bid, but now you have to go to here when everybody else had the chance. But this is a great program. It's generated over $188 million for the state. That doesn't include the PR match. We can't afford to lose it. So I will say this. If we can't find a way to satisfy what the division's after, we would support it. Thank you.
Thank you. My vice chair is not doing his job.
We hit it behind the screen.
Kevin?
Kevin Norman, representing myself. I was waiting patiently for my comments, and they kind of got hit on. One big perfect example of why this wouldn't work is the Henry tag, for instance. The three-year average on it is $99,000 this year at the Expo, which is the best venue in the world to sell a tag at. It went for $60,000-$65,000, right, Mike? So that's a perfect example why this won't work. to get in the weeds just a hair, I was in the meeting when this topic came up, and the whole reason the meeting or this topic is where it's at is because of the online auction option. Some groups may not have as many chapters and banquets, and they have more tags and they could sell at a banquet, so that's an option. If that tag is not advertised properly and sold, I mean, it could potentially no sell. The online option presents the issue. It's not the live banquet option. And so maybe, I mean, it's been touched on, and maybe the wording needs to be rewritten that it has to do with the online stuff and if it happens to no sell that way. That's just my two cents. Thanks.
Thank you. We have no other cards from the public. Back to comments from the rack, and I like Matt's comment, so he can expand on that, Matt.
So I really think that it'll work if we limit this to say that they have to purchase it for 100% of the average unless it's at a live auction. That means witnesses, that means it's not something that's deliberately poorly advertised. It means there are people there.
You know, the live public auction. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Kevin?
Matt, did you say and 100%? Added 100% or?
No.
Okay.
If it's at a live auction, it's whatever the highest bid.
Yeah, I
my comment would be I like that, and I don't. I do not like the online option. It's not well advertised. People are notified about public auctions and the banquets, but online is just not well enough advertised and available, in my opinion.
Okay. Well, and that's a rule we can't. I mean, we're not going to go in those muddy waters of they can or can't online. I mean, that's a whole different story for a different day, correct? We're just talking about this.
The rule's open now, though.
Okay, thanks for your comment. Melissa?
So it's been about 12 years since I've been at one of these live auctions, but that's why I'm not very familiar with what the issues are. But Randy, you had some questions and concerns and other things you were addressing. Would Matt's discussion we're having around the proposal that Matt had, would that relieve some of the concerns that you're thinking about?
Yeah, I think having something written in place and with Matt's option, I think that's a fantastic option. But I think I really, really agree that something has to be written. And I'm not even saying it's been abused, but you put something down so that everybody knows this is how it works. But that, I think, is a great fix.
I think perception is a really important thing as well. So that's good to hear that might be a way to solve that while still allowing for highest bidders to provide funding for conservation.
Matt?
If there are no more comments, I'd like to make that motion.
Second.
Matt, go ahead. Make the motion.
Okay, so I make a motion that we accept the proposal as written, except in the case of officers or agents, they have to purchase the tag at 100% of average unless it's at a live auction.
I'll second. Yeah, so the motion by Matt is accepted as presented unless they have to purchase it as the rules is proposed unless it's at a live public auction.
That would be the only place that they could purchase it.
Okay. Okay.
A second.
Second. Discussion on the motion.
Quick comment on it. I think we're the second rec meeting.
Yes.
Okay. I don't know if it passes or not. If it passes, I would recommend that this same addendum be brought up. I'm assuming you're making all the presentations, Justin.
Can I save you a little bit of time?
Yes, I'll do the rec tour. Yes.
I would suggest that you comment or bring up this observation to the other groups so that they're aware. It doesn't mean they're going to agree with us, but so that they're aware of a potential solution that might make everyone happy.
Yeah, I think we waded through a lot tonight, but this is certain. Well, I'll let everybody vote, but if it went this way, this is something the division would be fine with. So.
Was there any discussion at the central?
There were a few questions, but not on this topic. So.
The people up north are just really smart.
We're more enlightened.
Yeah, we're more enlightened. Okay. No more discussion on the motion. All in favor? Unanimous. Thank you, Justin. Appreciate the discussion. Hopefully we don't have flat tires in our cars when we go out to them tonight. Okay. That being said, our next meeting, May 15th. That sound right-ish? Okay. Make a motion, or somebody give me a motion to adjourn.
Make the motion to adjourn this meeting.
I'll second.
So moved. Adjourned.